legendary James Brown fan leader Fred Wesley, author of The Taliban Shuffle, Kim Barker, and Chicago actor, writer, filmmaker, and musician David Singer. Now here's your host, a man who melted today, Justin Kaufman.
But more because I'm a witch than it's hot. Right? Got some water on me. Welcome to The Download, everybody. I'm Justin Kaufman here on WGN Radio till 11 o'clock tonight. What an amazing night in Chicago. There are so many cars. Everywhere. It is full traffic here on Michigan Avenue for all the different festivals that are happening here and happening all around the region. And we hope to be somewhat of a companion for you tonight with some great, great guests. I'm very excited tonight because my guest here in the 7 o'clock hour is Kim Barker. She's a former Chicago Tribune reporter who wrote the book The Taliban Shuffle, Strange Days in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Kim Barker's book was the inspiration for the movie Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. Is that right? Yeah. It was starring Tina Fey. Just came out. So we'll talk to Kim Barker, who's here for the Lit Fest. Very excited to talk with her. Last night was amazing, Pete. I mean, we had so much Lit Fest. I felt like it was like overload Lit Fest, but it was so good.
It almost felt like I was reading.
Which you know if you're there.
Yeah.
But it was really good. I really enjoyed the conversation, and it was nuanced because we had the conversation with the Broadway composer Scott Frankel. We had R.L. Stine, the children's author, and then Ana Castillo, who's the poet. So a lot of different sort of variety around the Lit Fest, and we continued that variety tonight with a woman whose book went mainstream. So we'll talk with her coming up here at 7:30. At 8 o'clock, David Singer's going to join us. It'll be a second time through. Great Chicago Renaissance man, really. He's a writer. He's an actor. He's a playwright. A filmmaker, musician. He did the score for August Osage County, Steppenwolf. He's going to be back at Steppenwolf coming up on the 24th with his band. We'll talk with David about that. And, of course, his release, the feature film that he's been working on. It should be out sometime in 2016. And then coming up at 9 o'clock, I'm so excited about this. Fred Wesley, Pete can attest, I have been jamming the JBs, James Brown and the JBs, all day long.
I think I've listened to more funk music today than I have in my last 20 years combined. It was so great.
In the office, I'd be like, hey, Pete, can you give us some water? Give us some water. Dun, dun, dun. Hey. Pete's not dead. No, he ain't. So fun, man. Fred Wesley, the band leader and trombonist for the James Brown Band, the JBs. And then when he got done with the JBs, he's like, I'll just do some independent stuff. I'll work with George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic. Nah, do some indie stuff. You know, I mean, I can't think of someone who has more impact on American music as we know it than Fred Wesley. And he is coming in studio to talk with us tonight. I'm so excited. I'm so happy. He's headlining at the Chicago Blues Festival tomorrow night. But first, he's here on The Download. So excited about that. And, of course, it's Friday night. So you know what Friday night means. 10 o'clock. It's time for The Frying Pan with Steve Gadlin, local innovator, inventor, entrepreneur. Brings his new ideas to The Download before he brings them to his boss, Mark Cuban. He won on the show Shark Tank. This idea, I want to draw a cat for you.com. And so now he brings new ideas here to workshop before he brings them to Mark Cuban. So, you know, yay or nay. Mostly nays, not going to lie. But tonight, and I say this a lot, Steve's been texting me and he has his confidence. He has his swagger back.
Mm-hmm.
I know you were on some of those texts too. He's got that swagger back. He feels like this is the week that he is going to win over Download Nation. 312-981-7200. Text and call for that segment coming up at 10 o'clock. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier. Production provided by, of course, Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. What kind of show is it? It's a show! Dun, 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 dun. Pete, take us to the break! Dun, 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 dun. Gotta do the carry out after the break! Dun, 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 dun. All right, Friday night, this wonderful Midwest city and region. I'm so excited. It's a download. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's get this show started, shall we? Why don't we start with the carryout? Of course, this is our nightly segment where I read the newspaper, so you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. A feel-good Friday story for you. Moody's downgraded the state of Illinois bond rating. We are now two levels above junk, which, to be honest, I thought we were much closer to. Two levels above? Plenty of time to get there, lawmakers. Enjoy your summer boat parties. We'll get you off your yachts when we get to level one. Cool? Now hit the merengue. Update on the Lucas Museum saga. Oh, wait. No, there's not. Sneed reported that the Friends of the Park were going to support the idea of moving the Lucas Museum to the old McCormick Place site, to which the Friends of the Park said, no, that's not accurate. Jeez, this museum drama is more exciting than Episode 1, The Phantom Menace. But who's Jar Jar Binks in this scenario? It's got to be Rom, right? Or is Rom Darth Maul? Interesting casting dilemma here. We should ask George Lucas. Fans got to say goodbye to the champ Muhammad Ali today in Louisville, Kentucky. Again. When I die, I'd love to have a couple funerals, just to make sure everyone gets a chance to write a blog about it. What? I love Ali as much as the next guys, but geez, come on, all right, we get it. Today, the presidential candidates start getting after each other, officially. Clinton's focused on courting women. Donald Trump, just ogling them. The news site Gawker declared bankruptcy today and will be sold at auction, this all because of the Hulk Hogan lawsuit settlement. So word to the wise, American journalist, if you call out a wrestler for having sex with his friend's wife while he spews the N-word, you're probably going to go bankrupt. A man posing as an Apple employee in Soho ran off with 19 iPhones. I guess he fooled everybody by being disinterested in the customer's questions and asking, well, did you just turn it off? We'll turn it back on. Reboot it. Starting next week, the hookup dating app Tinder is banning anyone under the age of 18, which is pretty creepy to just be getting around to that. Really? You let 40-year-olds swipe left on 16-year-olds? And Gawker is going out of business? Traffic is bad tonight since the city of Chicago has decided to host every event known to man. You like baseball? You like sailing? You like the blues? You like food trucks? How about wine? And there's no wine fest, but you should drink some. In weather? Oh, it's so hot. Mookie! It's too hot. It's too hot to... Yeah, you know it. Love it. In sports, the Sox continue to purge veterans, adding Jimmy Rollins to the scrap heap. He was released today. Not good for a team that needed these journeymen to help for a playoff run. But this makes room to bring up top prospect Tim Anderson. I hope he's ready. Hey, they drafted a catcher yesterday in the first round. Let's get him up to the team too, right? Join this weekend. How hard is it to catch? One fastball, two curve, and remember at the end of each warm-up to throw to second base. Boom, done. Anyway, the Sox go for a two-game win streak with Chris Sale searching for his 10th win against the Royals. The Cubs are in Hotlanta, and Anthony Rizzo was scratched tonight. I say keep him out till September. No reason to grind it out in June. Tommy Gunn, Tommy La Stella hits the DL, and Chris Coughlin takes his place. Welcome back, Chris. The NBA Finals, Game 4 tonight. Will the Cavs make this a series, or will the Warriors shoot a bunch of threes? Gordie Howe died today at the age of 88 years old. Mr. Hockey will always be known as one of the best, and we hope that every hockey player will honor him by striving for the old Gordie Howe hat trick. It's a goal, an assist, and a fight. And finally tonight, an adult diaper fetish business has moved into Mount Prospect, and the residents there are not happy. Listen, adult diapers, they're for your business, not for your business. That's the carryout for July 10th, 2016. Hey, our dinner special tonight, a bag of ice. Try two. Coming up, we're going to talk with Kim Barker. She's the author of The Taliban Shuffle. She'll be at Lit Fest tomorrow night, or tomorrow morning, I should say. Sorry about that. Tomorrow morning, she, of course, is the woman who is behind Taliban Shuffle, which was made into Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, the movie with Tina Fey. We'll talk with Kim coming up right here after the news. Stay with us. It's a download. This download here on WGN Radio. Coming up, we're going to talk with Kim Barker. And, of course, tonight, Fred Wesley is going to be here from the JBs. I'm so excited to talk with Fred Wesley. who now is Fred Wesley and the new JBs, and they'll be the headliners at the Chicago Blues Fest tomorrow night. It's just been quite a day. I don't think I'm ever going to try. I'm never going to listen to any other kind of music. I found my soundtrack. I really did. All day, I was like, every song that came out, I'm like, I love this song. I know this song. I love this song. Fred Wesley is a genius. And I now have something to blast from the windows on a steamy, hot day.
Perfect day.
Oh, my. I was just double parking in front of outdoor restaurants. You know? So they're like, what is that guy doing? Gonna have a fun good time. Dun, dun, dun. Gonna take you higher. So I was... Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
I am so worried about you.
This is good for me. I've got an identity.
I'm actually excited about it because a little known fact about yours truly, I played the trombone from fourth grade through senior year in high school.
As a senior in high school, did you start to turn towards more of the funky kind of trombone, where trombone was used in more sort of R&B funk stuff like it was in James Brown?
I wasn't all that good, you know? It was just kind of fun. I was able to play the trombone and be in the marching band while playing football as well. Right. So it was, you know.
Well, that's your options, right? Marching band, you can get in a ska band.
Yeah.
That could go.
I wasn't good enough to be in the jazz band.
The jazz band, and then, you know. or you could go rogue and go funk R&B.
Then, of course, they had the district orchestra for the really good, you know. No, this is going to be good. I'm looking forward to this interview.
Yeah, I'm excited. I can't wait for him to be here. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up next hour, we're going to talk with David Singer. David Singer, great musician and filmmaker here in town. He did the original score for August Osage County at Steppenwolf. And he is going to be back at Steppenwolf with his band, Sweet Science. And we'll talk to him also about his movie, which he came in here, if you remember, he came in here last summer. And he talked about shooting the movie. So he's just about to release it. So we'll talk with David. And then, of course, Fred Wesley from the James Brown Band, JB's, will be here in studio after that. He's headlining the Chicago Blues Festival. All right, my guest now. Well, tomorrow the Printers Row Lit Fest takes place in the Printers Row neighborhood of Chicago. By now, you should probably have heard that because there's been a lot of people on our show, Rokon show, all the shows. Because, I mean, it's great. It's a great event, and we really like to be a part of it. One event that's a must-see tomorrow morning is at the Hotel Blake at 10 a.m. It's called How to Represent the Contemporary War Experience. And it features none other than Kim Barker. Barker's the author of the wildly successful The Taliban Shuffle, which was turned into the movie Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, starring Tina Fey. Barker worked here at the Chicago Tribune, covering both Afghanistan and Pakistan during her five-year stint abroad. She was actually with the paper for about 8 years. She now works at the New York Times as the Metro reporter, and she's my guest and here on The Download. Kim, nice to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Nice to meet you.
Thanks for being here. So how often do you get back to Chicago? Is it exciting to come back to Chicago at all?
Yeah, no, I love Chicago. It's such a wonderful city. And I love like the lakefront and being able to go ride my bike without fear of being run over by cars that much.
Right.
Unlike New York, where I was run over by a car.
You were?
Yeah, it wasn't that serious, though. I mean, I'm still here.
Yikes. Yeah. Oh, man, I almost detoured the whole interview.
I know. You're like, wait a second. Do you need trauma counseling?
No, I want to hear this.
I'm fine.
That's like one of my biggest fears.
Hey. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So let's talk about, you're going to be here talking about how to represent the contemporary war experience. Is this one of those things where the Lit Fest and the Tribune approach you for this kind of panel, or is this something that you've been sharing this story ever since the book was so popular in the movie?
Well, I've been sharing the story, and then, you know, obviously I have a pretty close relationship with the Tribune and the Tribune Company, since they're the ones that sent me over there and, you know, gave me my paycheck and everything, and they've been really supportive with the book. So I came here for Printer's Row a few years ago when the book first came out, and then this year I think they just felt like it was, you know, a good time to bring me back, and I think they were really hoping that they could get Tina Fey. But that didn't work.
They're like,
out.
Kim, we'd love to have you.
I'm now like the B-list Tina Fey. No, I am. I'm serious. It's like I always have to say, I know you thought you were going to get Tina Fey, but it's just me. And if you want somebody who was played by Tina Fey, it's pretty much me or Sarah Palin.
That's it. Well, here in Chicago, we have a different relationship with Tina Fey because she was at Second City. So just so you know, you know, we would rather talk with you.
Oh, really?
We love Tina, but we'd rather get your story. So let's talk about that. I mean, there's so many great themes that come out of the book and obviously are explored in the movie as well. But the themes of the, what I really enjoyed was the fact that there are, it's a very complex region, obviously, when you talk about Afghanistan and Pakistan, but there's this book is really not just about all the politics and everything that's happening in the war on terror, but it's about you. And it's about sort of your relationship with that area. What compelled you to write a book about it?
Well, I was there from 2004 to 2009. And at a certain point, I think a bunch of us foreign correspondents sitting around in Afghanistan were just like, somebody needs to write a darkly comic book about what it's like being here because it's so absurd. Through an absurd lens is the only thing that makes sense of like all the mistakes that have been made in that region, mm-hmm. whether it's by, you know, America going in there, whether it's, you know, by... you know, Pakistan, whether it's by, you know, journalists and aid workers who go in there. And, you know, if you don't have a sense of humor about it, you would probably, you know, end up crying. And then also, you know, the nightlife was just such a strange thing. I had not anticipated the fact that there would be these crazy parties like toga parties yeah. in Kabul, Afghanistan. That just made no sense to me whatsoever. And just the sort of level of decadence you had at the same time you were in a war zone. And of course, anybody who's been in a war zone understands that. But, you know, I'm naive and it was my first time over there. So I saw that as something that was interesting. You know, basically in 2009, the Tribune decided to sort of restructure how it had foreign correspondents. And I was one of the folks who was called back to Chicago. And I felt like I had a chance to write, you know, decide whether I was going to write that book I always talked about, that darkly comic mm-hmm. book, or, you know, come back to Chicago.
Or which shift into something else.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, basically, I felt like, well, let's take a chance. Let's write the funny book. And so that's what I did. I quit to write the funny book. And I was, you know, also just trying to find a way to make people read about Afghanistan and Pakistan. You know, I was really concerned about the directions of the countries. I was really upset with the directions of the countries. I wanted to find out a way that would make it accessible to everybody to read mm-hmm. so that by the time they finished reading it, they would unwittingly learn, have a basic primer on the region and learn something, but that they would also find the story, you know, funny and sad and a little bit heartbreaking in places. So I'm very much like a foil for America, you know, naive, sort of a bit arrogant, a bit like not understanding the culture when I first go in there. You know, you've got Farouk, who is my translator, who's the foil for Afghanistan. You got Nawaz Sharif, now the prime minister of Pakistan, who's the, you know, foil for Pakistan, you know, and it goes on. And I didn't really think about it when I was writing it. Like, this is kind of a memoir. I thought about it. This is the character of Kim Barker, the journalist. And I tried. So I included warts
really?
And all. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Do you still to this day think of it as less of a memoir and more that you just sort of created
a
caricature?
Well,
yourself?
And it wasn't a caricature. It was a character. I mean, I feel like this. Like, anytime you're writing a long story, a long feature as a journalist, you have somebody who's called a water carrier, who carries the story through, who's
sure.
more of a microcosm, who is the eyes that lets you see the story as a reader. And so I am those eyes. So I felt like I had to divorce myself from the character of Kim a bit, because otherwise I wouldn't have included half the things I included in there, because they're embarrassing and they don't make me look smart sometimes. They make me look mean sometimes. They make me unlikable sometimes. And you know what makes you unlikable? Covering war. And you know what? Not every journalist knows what they're doing over there. But the thing with a lot of journalist memoirs is they're very, very serious.
Right.
And they're also like the smartest people in the room, because that's what you have with the benefit of hindsight. It's super easy to be the smartest person in the room when you're looking back. You know, I was not the smartest person.
Well, it also makes you relatable, because as you said, you know, a lot of the books that are written about war zones or about journalists in war are almost, you know, there is this sort of like really precious kind of experience around it. For you, it was relatable. And also, I feel like the best way to put it is it just for an area that we get news articles about, even when mm-hmm. you're writing for the Tribune, you're writing about, that's almost the appropriate way we're being told the story about war.
Right.
And to be able to get a novel or a memoir or whatever you want to call it, like an experience like the Taliban mm-hmm. Shuffle, it's something that I think we're just not used to.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and for me, I was trying to channel, I think there used to be more of a tradition of having dark comedy and war. You know, you had MASH, you had, you know, Catch 22, you had, you know, Dr. Strangelove, and you had, you know, novels by Kurt Vonnegut. And there used to be this sort of tradition that seemed to have kind of stopped. And I don't know if it has to do with the fact that the draft stopped. Hmm. But we used to all know somebody, whether it was in your family or whether it was your neighbor, who had been affected by war.
War was in everybody's life.
We had now pushed it off to the side. Only certain people fight our wars, and they are not the wealthy, and they are not the elite. They are the people who are true believers, who are patriots, or they are people who are poor, and they want to find a way out of their poverty, a way to pay for school, you know? And all of these are perfectly respectable things to do, but, like, most people don't have to see war. They're the people who see the war for us, you know? And I kind of, like, and it's funny, because, like, after doing the book, anytime I meet like a Marine or a soldier, they're like, your book is the only thing that made sense of how messed up it was over there. So it's like, I feel like I share something with them and, you know, or aid workers or, you know, diplomats, anybody who was over there is like, oh yeah, your book is the only thing that made sense of like what I saw over there and all the sort of, you know, mess ups,
and the
snafus. Let's just call them snafus. I keep wanting to swear and I realize I cannot swear. It's WGN. You know, I'm a journalist after all. But, you know, and then I would tell people back home, I'm writing a funny book, a darkly funny book about war. And they would say, there's nothing funny about war. And I'd say, you know, it's not like people have to live. And people use a sense of humor to be able to cope with really awful things. I mean, anybody who's been through any level of tragedy knows that. Or if you're a cop or, you know, a doctor.
Making that decision to write a funny book about war and then to have it quickly optioned to and quickly made into a movie starring Tina Fey. I mean, was there ever a point in the actual experience, the wild roller coaster ride that was, that you were like, I hope people don't really get mad at me for writing a funny book about war?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really think about it when I was doing it. I just knew it was something I had to get out, and the book poured out of me. I wrote it really quickly. You know, and then you're only afterwards, I thought to myself, there's a lot of me in this book and I'm not likable in places and people might not like me. And my mother was very concerned about it. My mother is from Chicago, by the way. And she says, you got to take all these things out. It's going to make you very unlikable and people aren't going to like my daughter. And so then I went through and I edited all those things out because it was before the book went to press. And my editor came back and said, you just surgically removed all the funny in this book and it's going back in. Wow. I said, okay, fine. You know, and you just sort of have to accept that in life, not everybody's going to like you. And in life, not everybody is going to think that what you think is funny. And that is fine. That is okay. And I'm kind of like, ever since then, I feel like I keep challenging myself more to take, you know, different sort of risks. Obviously, I took risks over in Afghanistan and Pakistan. But now it's just, you want to speak in front of 8,000 people? Sure. Scares the hell out of me. But why not?
Why not?
You want to throw out the first pitch at the White Sox
game? Which you
game?
Did last night. Yeah.
Yeah. Why not? I have no idea what I'm doing, but let's do it, you know? And then, you know, I'm so nervous before doing it. And people are saying, but you were in Afghanistan. I'm like, that's different. That was private. That was just me being scared of certain things. This is public humiliation.
You know, for all of what happened in the book and you know, and the getting there and not knowing what to expect, when you left in 2009, and you've talked about this, that you almost were addicted to that area, the region, to Pakistan, to Afghanistan. Talk about that, because that's something that we wouldn't necessarily think about people who cover war or are involved in war, that they would want to be in those places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. I'd been based over there for 5 years, and I kept just wanting to stay until the story was over. How naive is that, you know? And I just really, fell in love with the people of Afghanistan, and I really felt like I wanted it to succeed. And watching it as it started to slip away was very difficult, and I wanted to be there to chronicle it. I felt like I owed it to this place that I had fallen in love with, you know? So the idea of leaving was just not in me. You know, I fought for like whatever remaining jobs there were in Tribune Company as hard as I possibly could. And then when I was told I was coming back, I just thought, okay, I'm going to quit. I'm going to freelance. I'm going to write this book out of Afghanistan, because that seems like a quiet place to write a book about Afghanistan and Pakistan. And that's what I did. I quit because I couldn't see leaving it, you know? And I planned to stay there. And even when I got this fellowship at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, you know, a few months later, I thought, okay, I'm going to go do this fellowship and I'm going to live in New York, but I'm going to leave all my stuff in Afghanistan. And I am coming back after I write this book and after the fellowship. And that's what I planned to do. And it didn't go back. And I think it was through being back in New York and sort of seeing how jagged I had become and how, difficult I was to be around. And, you know, I was the sort of person who would, I'd be at a bar with friends and I'd say, $15 for a drink? Do you know what that could buy in Afghanistan? I mean, that's just not fun. You know, and people would be like, don't bring Debbie Downer back
here.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, reminding us about the people of Afghanistan and how lucky we are. You are very lucky out there, though, people.
Well, I mean, it's a great story, you know, for you being back in journalism. Do you miss the idea of being able to chronicle the events in a book like this? I mean, this is a different kind of writing. It's a different kind of thing. To get back into journalism, we covered whether you missed the region. Do you miss the sort of buzz that came with writing the Taliban Shuffle?
I miss playing with so many words. It's amazing to have, you know, 100,000 words to play with, because my editors are always bothering me, you know, can you please write a 1,000 word story? And I turn on in, you know, I'm like, that's just throat clearing. I can't do anything in 1,000 words, you know, and like with what's happened in journalism and newspapers, it's, you got to get it done in 600 words. People do not have the time. And so I do miss like the idea of just saying, okay, let's make that more evocative. Let's make that paragraph funnier. Let's do something more with rhythm. You know, I miss that sort of just sitting around and playing with words, and you're doing it for yourself. You know, the act of writing a book is such a strange thing. You know, nobody's writing you every single day. I mean, yeah, theoretically you have an editor and a contract and stuff, but it's not like they've got a lot of other things to do. It's
and there's
on
a long
you.
Deadline, right?
Yeah, it's on you. And so, yeah, I would love to write another book. It's just hard to top a first book that's, you know, in which you're played by Tina Fey, because like I'm like, no matter what I do next time, people are gonna be like, not as good, not as interesting.
My favorite story of the reading all the stuff about the book and is the fact that Tina Fey saw the New York Times review of the book, in which the New York Times review mentions Tina Fey.
I know.
It says,
right?
It sounds like something Tina Fey would, or I forgot what it was, but.
It said, I created a Tina Fey character. I'm like, man, I am a Tina Fey character.
And she's like,
that.
I like this. She should get, I like yeah. this. Yes, I'll try it out. That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Because as she likes to say, she's a total egomaniac and Googles herself all the time. And so therefore, you know, read the review and within 2 weeks had read the book and pushed Lauren Michaels and Paramount to option it. And that's her joke. I would never make fun of Tina Fey.
The one thing that I know rubbed you the wrong way about the movie was that they changed it from a print journalist to a cable TV journalist.
I know.
Print journalists do not like TV reporters.
I like TV reporters. That's not true. Some of my best friends are TV reporters, and they have a different skill set. You know, my God, it's to have to go on TV like that live all the time. There's no way I could do it. Or act like you knew what was going on, or like you're adding new information. I couldn't do it. I would completely be like the Albert Brooks character, you know, just sweating through everything. It would never work out for me. So I think that they've got a different skill set, but I'm also pretty proud of, you know, print journalism and what we do. And the fact that like the industry is not exactly in the greatest place right now. I mean, witness Tronc, you know, and yet I still feel what we do and what the Tribune does is so important. And there's still like just amazing journalists here doing amazing journalism. So, yeah, of course, I would have liked to have highlighted that a little bit more. But I get what they were doing and I understand why they did it.
Kim Barker is the author of The Taliban Shuffle. She is going to be at the Printers Row Lit Fest tomorrow at the Hotel Blake at 10 a.m. She's on a panel called How to Represent the Contemporary War Experience. Colin McMahon's going to interview her. Thanks so much for being here, Kim. We appreciate it.
Yeah,
and,
thank you.
Good luck with everything.
Thanks a lot.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, Dave Singer's going to be here. We're going to talk about his big show coming up at Steppenwolf. It's in the new 1700 stage, which is where the new bar is at. Remember Chris Jones was saying, Steppenwolf's got a new bar.
Yeah.
This is like the theater that's kind of adjoining it. So we'll talk. So we'll just, you know, we should just have all the artists that work at Steppenwolf just come on and give reviews of the new bar. Oh, there's a new bar in Chicago. Someone texted in at saying, did Kim Barker just say things aren't good for journalists? Witness Trump? Why the gratuitous swipe? No, she said trunk.
Yeah.
Sorry. That's interesting that they're very close to each other. And trunk, as in the new name for the Tribune company.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. Also, of course, keep forward promoting that Fred Wesley's going to be here. So excited. I know. He's landed. He's on his way.
He's so landed. Good. All right. We'll
I know.
Here.
I was so worried. I was like, I make so many shots at the airports, you know, and the carryout.
Mm-hmm.
I always make fun of O'Hare or United. And I'm just like, you know, they're going to get me back tonight. Oh, that flight that Fred Wesley's coming in on? Delayed. Oh, you're going to be on the download? Delayed. I was just waiting for that. I was like, oh, no. But
we know if he's bringing in his horn?
I don't know.
If he does, can you have him play the Michigan cheer? I mean, it's so beneath him, but I think it would be cool.
We've got Fred Wesley, one of the probably the most famed trombonist songs of pop culture history. Will you play the fight songs?
Yeah.
All we do is an hour of fight songs.
But he
songs.
Could funk it up, though.
That would be so good. I don't know. I don't know how that would work. Roe and I were talking about it a little bit. I mean, a trombonist, are they like a trumpeter where they bring the trombone with them everywhere they go? It's such a big instrument. It's got to be pretty clunky. I would think that they're not carrying it around like a purse, right? How did you do it, Martyr, in high school?
Were you the guy bringing
the trombone?
Look, I had the clunky case, but they've streamlined the cases, so they're not as big and bulky as they used to be.
If I was a musician, I'd bring the case around everywhere. I took guitar lessons. I took my guitar case on everything that I possibly could to look like I was something of a musician.
I had a Schadenfreude show in Europe, and we did this show. We ended up at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And there was one scene in which we used a guitar as a prop, right? And I think maybe it played it, strummed it a little bit. I had to carry it from Chicago in a backpack case all the way through Heathrow, all the way up to Edinburgh, all the way through trains and you know, ferries to have this on me. There's pictures of me walking across Abbey Road because I did some sightseeing in London before we got there with the carry, like I'm a musician.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, getting on
like
the tube.
Troubadour.
Yeah, getting on the tube. Excuse me. Coming through with my Yamaha acoustic that's got one strum in this comedy show I'm doing. I couldn't get the 125, shell out the 115 pounds at the time to get a new guitar. Yeah, so like I was that guy. Just a guitarist. Yeah, I'm playing Edinburgh.
Yeah.
It was like, I seriously, like three strums. I was such a, and I know in the back of my head, I loved it. You know, I loved it. Like, oh, look at me. Such a great guitarist. All right, we'll take a break. Come back. Dave Singer's here. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight when Patty Vasquez takes over. Coming up in the 10 o'clock hour, Steve Gadlin in the frying pan. Very excited. He's got a new invention he wants to try out here to Download Nation. And you always come through. Give him good constructive criticism. I say constructive. 312-981-7200. That's coming up at 10 o'clock. And, of course, coming up really quick here in the next hour is Fred Wesley, the famed trombonist for the amazing band, the JBs, James Brown and the JBs. Dave Singer knows what I'm talking about.
I do.
David Singer's a musician, writer, filmmaker, and all-around Renaissance man here in town. He's returned to the Steppenwolf Theater with his band, David Singer and the Sweet Science, doing a show. It's on the 24th, and it's part of the Steppenwolf's Lookout Series, a new performance series in the 1700 space, which is right by the new bar.
It is. It's actually behind the new bar. I'm optimistic about.
We had Chris Jones in here, and he spent 3 minutes on the new bar. And I'm like, why are we talking about a new bar? Like, I thought we were talking theater, but this is a big deal for Steppenwolf.
In the old days, the bar that went with Steppenwolf was O'Rourke's.
O'Rourke's across the way, right?
The Saint at O'Rourke's, which I may or may not have had my first 500 beers in high school. But yeah, since O'Rourke's has been gone, there's been a hole in everyone's heart that now being filled by the front bar.
Don't they serve wine at the Apple Store? That's right around the corner.
They probably do.
They still got the furniture store right next door, the Ethan Allen? That's gone, huh?
Gone.
That's what this is taking the place of?
They're taking over the whole thing.
Ah.
They're going to expand west. They're going to own that container store in a couple of years, too. They're going to get the whole thing.
David is a great talent. He did the original music for August, Osage County, and we're still excited for his debut feature film, Imperfections, which is going to be released very soon. He was on the program last summer talking about filming it, and we'll catch up on that story. David, great to see you, man.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You brought your guitar, which is great.
So I did.
That's good. Okay, so let's talk about this. I mean, the idea of performing as a band and not a show at Steppenwolf, where did this come from?
Well, I think that Steppenwolf for a long time has looked for ways to integrate other types of programming. You know, it's a big place and it's kind of a cultural institution. And I think part of the mandate now is to find ways to have a space that's more flexible and incorporate more things. I mean,
not just theater.
I'm not in a boardroom somewhere figuring this out, by the way. I'm just like a guy who was lucky enough to get a call. The theater is now under the artistic direction of my friend Anna Shapiro. And I think that part of their campaign is to try to make it a multidisciplinary, inclusive, kind of cool hub for a lot of different kinds of things. And one of the things is this bar that they talked about. And then behind it is a little black box theater called the 1700 Theater.
Well, you've had a tremendous sort of history with the Steppenwolf Theater. I mentioned August Osage County, but there's been other shows, too, that you've done music for and you've worked with Anna. So talk about that and the relationship that you've built in this institution.
Well, I've been very fortunate in that I've gotten to do a lot of things. I mean, August Osage County was actually the first play I ever worked on, which is kind of a good
start.
I mean, like,
start.
The irony of me treading water in punk rock for 15 years and then starting with August Osage County is not lost on me. But Anna is a good friend and a collaborator, and I've been fortunate to work with her on a bunch of stuff. We did Three Sisters at Steppenwolf, also with Tracy Letzigen, who's a very nice person and my friend. And I got to go to New York the year before last now, and do Of Mice and Men with
classic,
Anna
on
Broadway, which was very exciting. And I had great thrill. And so I spend most of my time sitting by the phone waiting for her to call. You know, she's old school. She doesn't know how email works. So, yeah, it's just a call. It's a rotary phone.
For you, I mean, obviously the music, you like, as you mentioned, 15 years in punk rock and Kid Million, other stuff too. But you also, I mean, with Sweet Science and playing music and being a musician, is it a difficult transition to write music for theater?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think the watchword for me has always been to just kind of jump, and like, if you pretend like you know what you're doing and you ask questions when you get backed into a corner, that people are generally nice to you. So it seemed like the kind of thing that I could do. So I just sort of tried it and it worked out. I don't mean to be coy about it, but I'm self-taught. I never went to music school. I took 4 guitar lessons from a hippie in 1978. So like anything that
A magic hippie, though. Let's be fair. It was a magic hippie.
Well, that's what he told my parents. But yeah. I was very lucky, and it was nice to get into an environment like Steppenwolf and like working with Anna and Tracy, where they sort of just turned me loose, which is the ideal way to collaborate with people. And now that I've transitioned into doing filmmaking, it's a lesson that I really took to heart, which is that be scrupulous in finding people whose work you believe in and who you feel like you can trust, and then stay out of the way and let them do their thing unless they're taking you totally off the rails. You know, that's yeah, how it works. It's collaborative.
Right.
And it's that was the big transition for me was figuring out that, you know, I was in a band with 3 guys that I grew up with and then a couple of other guys I've known for 20 years. So you just put 3 guys in a van with a bunch of equipment and you can go do anything, and it doesn't require oversight or really a lot of thought or planning. Whereas this was the opposite. This is extremely collaborative with a lot of people, and you have to fit stuff into little gaps. And it was a complicated thing to learn, but I kept my head down and tried to just ask questions when I didn't know stuff and do the work.
Well, you're back with the Sweet Science, and you got your guitar with you.
So I do.
Why don't we hear something? What are we going to hear here?
I'll tell you what. I'm going to play the song that's the title track from my record, East of the Fault Line.
East of the Fault Line, here on the download. David Singer, who's playing with his band, the Sweet Science. David Singer and the Sweet Science. It's on the 24th of June at the Steppenwolf's Lookout Series. David Singer live in studio.
Said the 6 to the 7 of spades. When the night is this clear, you can see it from here. The cherry estates were all dark, but we knew someone else was awake. And the moon hung so low and so big it looked fake. But the worst part is over now. All that's left is a hole in the ground. California's gone. Broke right off and then sank in the ocean. Western Nevada just got a promotion today. The seven of clubs to the eight. It was always a scheme, just a paranoid dream. We sat on the roof of the house, and the wind blew her hair in my face, and the smoke rose. Pale imitation of grace. But the worst part is over now. All that's left is a hole in the ground. California's gone. Broke right off and then sank in the ocean. Western Nevada just got a promotion. The highway is teeming with Calvary clover. Give all the young dreamers a chance to start over today.
David Singer live in studio. Nice. David, that was great. This David Singer and the Sweet Science is going to be at the Steppenwolf Lookout Series. It's on the 24th, June 24th, in a new 1700 space. Let's take a break. We'll come back. Well, I got to find out about the movie. What's going on with the movie?
I'll tell you all about it.
Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, David Singer. We just heard some live music from him. He's a musician. He's a writer. He's a filmmaker. David Singer in the Sweet Science.
I'm a shoot first point guard. I am.
You really are.
Yeah.
You're a crossover guy. You're what's ruining the NBA. The shoot first NBA point guard.
I agree. Yeah. And I told Steph Curry to make those Under Armours, by the way. That was my design.
That was yours?
Yeah.
Okay, the show's on the 24th of June. It's part of the Steppenwolf Lookout Series in the new 1700 space. But David, you were here last summer talking because you had a great article in the Tribune about shooting, and we were talking about shooting and editing the film Imperfections. Where are we at with that?
The movie is done.
Yeah.
It's done. Thank you, people. We finished shooting just about a year ago, and it takes a really long time to make a movie. I don't know if anybody ever told you that before, especially if like Jack Warner isn't in the back chomping a cigar. It's just me and my brother John figuring it out.
That's not what Apple commercials tell me.
Yeah.
You can make a movie like that.
You can make one of those movies like that. Not this thing. The movie is done and we are getting ever closer to letting people know how they can see it. And in the meantime, if you want to check it out, the website of the movie is imperfectionsfilm.com. And there's a trailer for the movie.
So let's refresh everybody. So Imperfections, your debut feature film.
That's correct.
Tell us what it's about.
Okay, it's about an out-of-work actress who gets a job working as a courier in Jewelers Row. Now, this is a real thing. Like, Jewelers Row guys, they don't always use security companies to move stones from one place to another because they get robbed.
We talked about this
last time.
This
is a thing that actually happens. And they just hire young women and they stick hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of diamonds in their jeans pocket and send them from one place to another. Now, I'm not saying you should just go willy-nilly start robbing people in Jewelers Row, but you could. So the movie is about an out-of-work actress who gets a job as a courier or a schlepper for a diamond importer. And then she sort of realizes that she's not putting money together fast enough, and she conspires with the owner's son. The owner is played by Ed Begley Jr., to stage a robbery and keep the diamond and sell it and make money.
And hijinks ensues.
There are hijinks.
There are
danger,
so
high stakes.
Last time we talked, I mean, you were quickly wrapping up the shooting. And what's next in a movie? So talk about the editing process.
Okay, so the editing process is you have somebody whose job it is to, like, assemble everything. And then they give you a really long version of the movie with, like, every little thing strung out next to each other. Hmm. And then everybody who's ever made a movie tells you, look, when you see that thing, you're going to be suicidal. Like, it's always terrible. The assembly is always bad. And I was like, yeah. But secretly, I was thinking, this
mine's
going to be good. It was terrible. So I was, I had some deep insecurity for a couple of weeks, but we worked on it, and John and I kind of, like, honed everything down with our editor, Michael Heffler. What's up, Mike Heffler, if you're out there in Radioland. And, we finally got it in shape, and then we watched it and we showed it to a bunch of people, and we were like, it's fantastic. Now let's cut 15 more minutes out of it. So that's what we did. And we cut that by, you know, like one word at a time.
Right.
And so now we have a movie.
So what's the next step? Now we talked about the editing process. The next step is actually shopping it?
Well, the next step after editing it was scoring it. So I had to, like, sit in my little office and write music for the whole thing, which, by the way, is hard. It takes a long
time.
I mean, it was the least annoying client I ever worked for, but otherwise it would... But,
or the most.
Or the most, most demanding. But so then we scored the movie, and then you have to color correct it, and then you have to do the title sequence, and then you have to... There's a lot of things. And in, like, a big movie, everybody's working at the same time on that stuff. But in a small movie where it's me and John and a couple other people, it's like, knock this out.
You go in order,
And you know what? That's sort of the way that we got through the whole process, having never made a feature before. We made a short, and the short did really well.
Right.
And it was very exciting. But then, so we were like, okay, how are we going to make a feature? So first you write the script. Like, okay, now we wrote the script. Then you're going to have to raise some money. So we raised some money. It was like, okay, now hire a crew. And now cast the movie. And now do locations. And I was like, if you can just keep it to the thing that's in front of you, it's doable. If you look at it in its totality, it would have been too much. But
so now that the process is turning from the production to the marketing, which
correct.
Is in the movie, I mean, for you as a first-time filmmaker, you did the short, but the first-time filmmaker as a feature, how is your psyche?
It's fragile. Yeah. the prognosis is guarded, let's say that. No, I think I really like the movie. And that's a thing. You know, one of the things that translated from making records to making the movie is that I'm used to sitting in a dark room by myself and looking at the same thing over and over again for a year and figuring out, like, that works, that doesn't work, that kind of sucks, that I can live with. But after all this time, I can watch this movie and not look at it as just like a collection of things I wish I had done differently.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really proud of it. I really am excited to get it out into the world.
When are we going to get to see it?
Well, I don't
know.
Do
I get any sort of VIP treatment?
Yes, you can see it tonight.
Maybe not tonight. I got plans, but maybe.
Okay, but you can see it in the next 20 hours. We are figuring out where it's going to premiere.
Okay.
I mean, there's a whole thing. So now we have people who live in Los Angeles who are figuring out, like, how to get it out into the world. We finally turned it over to somebody who knows what they're doing. And so we'll figure out where it's going to premiere, and then whether it's going to be in theaters or whether it's going to be Netflix or whether it's going to be whatever it is.
Well, keep us in mind, because I'd love to have you back when
you
get to that point.
I'll come here every day. I might not leave. I've got my whole family here. Yeah, you can bring sandwiches.
Very
we'll
exciting in here. I feel like, you know, we had the conversation last summer. To pick back up in that conversation, I'd love to know what's next and the successes and failures of marketing the film. I mean, I think that's part of the fun of learning how people make films.
I'll say this, that the problem with the democratization of the tools of making movies, you know, like
everyone can make
a movie on their phone. The problem is everybody now makes a movie on their phone. So
is there
Sundance,
more competition for marketing and for getting in the festivals and things like
Sundance
that?
Sundance got 12,500 submissions this year, and they showed like 40 movies.
Right.
So it's how do you break through the cacophony of that?
David Singer is a filmmaker. The film Imperfections. What's the website again?
Imperfectionsfilm.com. We're on Twitter at a thing that would be hard to spell, at Imperfections. Or you can find me at DS Arrows on Twitter, and I'll show you how to get to the thing.
David Singer is a filmmaker, he's a writer, he's a musician. His band, David Singer and the Sweet Science, will be on stage at the Steppenwolf's new 1700 space as part of their Lookout series
on
the 24th.
Yes, please come to that. There are tickets available. 24th. There's some tickets left. I don't know how many, but if you go to Steppenwolf's website, which is probably steppenwolf.org, or you just call Gary Sinise, I'm sure he could hook you up. But there are tickets left. You can go get them in advance and then come and we'll play a bunch of songs and it'll be fun.
David Singer, great to see you.
2 weeks from tonight.
2 weeks.
Thank you for having me. Thank you, Justin. Thank you, Peter. Say Fred is dead. Say Fred is dead. Fred is dead. No, he ain't. Fred is dead. No, he ain't. Fred is dead. No, he ain't. Fred is dead. No, he ain't.
Tomorrow night, the Chicago Blues Festival will welcome a great slate of musicians, but none of them quite compare to my next guest, at least in my eyes. Heading tomorrow night, headlining Fred Wesley and the New JBs. Wesley is a music director, a band leader, and a trombonist. He's credited with bringing that funky horn sound that you hear right here to this country from the 60s and 70s and beyond. Wesley led the JBs, James Brown's famous band, alongside Maceo Parker, Pee Wee Ellis, and others. Wesley helped write and perform American classics like Gimme Some More, Pass the Peas, You Can Have Watergate, Just Gimme Some Bucks and I'll Be Straight. Oh, man, I've been listening to all these songs all day long. When the JBs disbanded in the late 70s, Wesley moved on to make legendary music with George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic. And why not throw in Count Basie? The Count Basie Band for measure, right?
That's right, yeah.
And add his solo work, now a new blues project, and Fred Wesley is a true American great, and he's my guest tonight on The Download. For Mr. Wesley, thanks so much for being my guest. I can't thank you, man.
Thank you so much for having me, you know? I'm glad to be in Chicago.
I just said, you know, do you recall coming back to Chicago? Talk about your experiences with this town, because James Brown, the JBs, you guys come through here.
Well, you know, James Brown came through here, and I was with him from 69 all the way through 74. We came here a number of times at the Auditorium Theater. Is the Auditorium Theater still here?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah. We used to play the Auditorium Theater.
It's a huge room.
And then I came through here. I know we did Parliament Funkadelic with the Earth Tour. It was when the spaceship landed on stage, you know, at
sure.
Soldier Field. It was a big deal.
What is,
you know?
I mean, you think about those times. I mean, and it's been we're talking decades now. But I mean, when you think back to those times at the Auditorium Theater, or coming through with James Brown's band, or landing the spaceship at Soldier Field,
yeah,
those are great. I mean, those are historic memories in music.
Yeah,
and you
were
involved in them.
And it was a big deal too, a great thing. Then I came through here again in 1978 with Count Basie. We played Park West. Is Park West still there?
Still here, yeah.
Yeah, we played over at Park West with Sarah Vaughan and some other singers, but the Count Basie band played it. So I've been in Chicago a lot. Chicago's like another home for me, you know?
Why don't we start at the beginning? What drew you to the trombone?
Oh, well, you know, I was taking trumpet lessons and saxophone lessons, and I've been taking piano lessons from age three. My grandmother was a piano teacher, and my father had a big band. And one day, his lead trombone player quit the band, so he needed a trombone player. So he told me, say, if you learn how to play this trombone by the end of the summer, you can be in the band. I'm 12 years old, you know. And so I was thrilled because I always wanted to play in his band. You know, I used to set the stands up for the band when they rehearsed and clean out the ashtrays, you know. And, you know, I always wanted to be in the band. He told me I could be in the band one day. I thought maybe I'd be in the band on trumpet or saxophone or something like that, you know. I didn't want to play piano because he played piano, you know. And but he needed a trombone player. So he got me a trombone, and I practiced on that horn all day, every day under a tree.
How hard is that instrument? I mean, the trombone is a difficult instrument to master.
It's difficult. It's not much more different from other instruments. All instruments are difficult to master because it's not a natural thing, you know.
Yeah.
But trombone was kind of different for me, you know. I knew how to play it without knowing exactly how to play it. You know, I didn't know how to, I knew how to finger the trumpet and finger the saxophone, but trombone had a slide. You know, you had to hit those notes exactly right on the slide. So I learned how to play the trombone, and sure enough, my father let me play in his band. And I was the third trombone player in my father's band. And a trombone player led to other gigs. I played blues with Charles Lott's band in Mobile, and some jazz with Joe Louis' band. And I just stuck with trombone.
You know, making that transition from that music, from blues and to jazz and playing in your dad's band, big band, when did the transition happen where you sort of got funky with it, where you started to think about the trombone in the way that we know it in the JBs and James Brown?
You know, I played with Ike and Tina Turner. I got a gig with Ike and Tina Turner back in, I think, 61 or 62. And Ike had a trumpet player named Mac Johnson that played a funky solo on a record of Can't Sit Down. You remember Can't Sit Down by Phil Upchurch? No, you don't know that. Phil Upchurch had a record.
I'll look it up.
You Can't Sit Down, and Mac Johnson played a funky solo on it. So that started me to thinking maybe I could play funk on a trombone, you know. So from that, I was playing with Ike and Tina Turner, and so I used to play some funky solos with the band, you know, and it went on. When I got off the band, I played with Hank Ballard and the Midnighters. I played more funky solos, and of course with James Brown, he found out I could play some funk on trombone. So you know, that really excited him because you know, Maceo was the man at first, so he thought he had somebody he could play against Maceo. You know, James Brown would like that. You know?
All right, we're gonna take a quick break, and then we'll pick back up with James Brown and the JBs. And such great music. Fred Wesley in studio with me. Fred Wesley and the new JBs are headlining at the Chicago Blues Festival tomorrow night. He's my guest tonight at the big table. Stay with us. This is the best trombone in music. Do you listen back to your stuff? And
yeah, I do.
When you hear that, and especially that.
I laugh at that, you know. Because at the time, I said, James Brown must be crazy. He want me to slide up to a note like that, you know. But I did it, you know. That's what James Brown liked about me. I would do anything that he said to do. He would come up with the wildest stuff in the world to do, and I would do it.
That's probably the first time a lot of mainstream Americans, I mean, for James Brown to be much more pop and funk than some of the jazz stuff. But it's the first time that American audiences were introduced, mainstream audience introduced to the trombone. That slide.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a big deal, you know, and James Brown kind of played off of that too. You know, he had a trombone player that could play funk, that could play jazz too, you know. And because I used to play some jazz solo. If you check out the Lost album, Fred, the JBs and Fred Wesley, it's got a lot of jazz on it too. You know, we did a album with Michael Brecker and Randy Brecker, and Dave Matthews did all the arranging on it, you know. And it was a album that was done, but it was put on the shelf until 2 years ago, and they put it out. They finally put it out 2 years ago.
We're talking with Fred Wesley. He's a trombone player, band leader, music director for the ages, Hall of Fame musician who was the leader of the JBs. He now has Fred Wesley and the new JBs, which are at the Blues Festival tomorrow night. Fred, I'm interested in is, you know, you were playing such great funk music with James Brown. Mm-hmm. And there was a point when the JBs became Fred Wesley's JBs. Talk about the transition from just being a trombone player in the James Brown band to leading that band.
Well, you know, James Brown wanted to reward me, I guess, for being a loyal side man, you know, because I kind of relished the fact that I was the greatest side man ever. You know, I was side man with Ike and Tina Turner, Hank Ballard, the Midnighters, with B.B. King and Ray Charles, and with James Brown. So James Brown was going to reward me. He tried to make me a star, but I couldn't do it because I just didn't have the hairstyle for it. And I didn't have the wardrobe for it, you know. And I don't know.
I saw some of the old pictures today. I think you did.
I tried, but I didn't have the temperament for it either. You know, I just wasn't a star type person. But he said he would give me the JB, so he put my name on "Gonna Have a Funky Good Time." You know, Fred Weston and the JBs, mm-hmm. and from then on, you know, we did three other albums behind that. You know,
some of the best music ever recorded.
You know, so I became a minor star, you know, but with Fred Wesley and the JB, so it was Fred Wesley and James Brown, so to speak.
You mentioned Sideman, and you write an autobiography in Sideman. Talk about what does that mean? What does Sideman mean? For someone who doesn't know music that well, talk about the idea of the Sideman.
Well, you know, a Sideman is very crucial to a star and to a band, really, because a Sideman has to be in place all the time, and I had to do his job all the time, or else the star kind of just flaps around in the wind. You know, you need a whole band full of good sidemen, which James Brown had. He had a band, he had Jimmy Nolan, Country Kellum, Jabbo, Clyde Stubblefield, Maceo Parker. He had a whole band full of great sidemen, you know, that could do what he said, when he said it, and how he wanted it to be done, mm-hmm. so he could do his thing, you know. So that's what a sideman does.
What happened to the sideman? Because now with a lot of musicians, the sideman disappears. I mean, maybe they'll have a full band on stage, but they're definitely not being credited the way that the JBs were back in the late 60s.
Well, you know, with music today, you can make an album in your bedroom, you know. You could just use the machine, the synthesizers and the drum machines and all the effects and things. You can do the vocals. You can do the vocals in your bedroom, make a whole album. You know, people do that. Mm-hmm. So it's changed, you know. But in our day, you had to have a band that would do what you said, how you wanted to do in order for you to do your thing, you know.
When your relationship with James Brown, so you mentioned a couple times like he really wanted, he'd push you, he'd want to give you credit, he gave you credit for your loyalty, but he also was taking risks with the music. What was your relationship like with James Brown?
It was a learning experience, you know, and it was speaking of taking risk, when he would take a risk, he would make me take a risk too, and you know, that's why I was good for him, because I would relish taking a risk with James Brown. If he would say, use a flute on this play, on this tune, or use a harp here, or give me a big band here, you know, I would do it. I would do it. I would do anything that he said do.
You trusted him.
I mean, he was kind of a visionary.
Yeah,
he trusted me, you know. And we worked real good together to a point. I mean, you know, he would wake me up in the middle of the night. I didn't like that, you know. He would make me stay up late, I didn't like that. But basically, I would do whatever he told me to do, as long as I could do it, you know. But he came to a point where he wanted me to copy people, and I drew the line.
That's when
I
you said that's not.
I said, I'm not doing that.
Well, anymore. I was going to ask about, you know, there's something special about that relationship, and there's a sort of shorthanded language. I mean, talk about your language with James Brown. You guys, I mean, even on the records, when I was listening to all the songs today, there's just a shorthand vocabulary.
Yeah.
You know, he's shouting out to you guys in the middle of the song.
Right. And that's where a good sideman comes in. See, we all knew what those shouts meant, you know. We all knew what those moves he made. We all knew what they meant because we were good sidemen. And I was the head leader of that, you know. Any move he made, any utterance that he came out of his mouth, we would know what it meant or made out like we know what it meant.
You know? Good performers, right.
Good performers. And see, he had to have that. He had to have that. You imagine James Brown without his band. He'd just be a guy skittering around
the
stage.
Well, I mean, there was such energy that he would toss around the stage.
Yeah.
So he would toss it to you, you know, like we just heard in the beginning.
And you had to be ready.
Yeah, you'd be ready for it. Yeah, but there was a lot of borrowing from old types of music, gospel music, call and response. There was a lot going on with the JBs and James Brown that even today has never been replicated.
That's true. And he would not only throw it to me, he would throw it to Pee Wee or the Maceo, and everybody, when it was hit your time to play, you don't know when it's gonna come, you know. But you had to be ready, and you had to play, you had to perform, or you would be out of the band, so to speak, you know.
You mentioned a little bit earlier Maceo Parker because you guys were kind of put together to sort of almost compete with each other on stage. What's your relationship like with Maceo Parker? Because another one is just a tremendous member
Maceo
of the JBs.
Is a star. You see, he's a star. He knows how to take over an audience and how to make an audience groove. You know, I never got that. You know, but Maceo was more of a star than I was. You know, he could play funk anytime you call him up, he'll play anything. But he also knew how to get an audience going. You know, I can get an audience going with the music, but I can't just stand there and just say, hit me and all. You know, like that. He was almost like James Brown.
Yeah.
He was very much like James Brown. He could get an audience fired up in a minute, and he would do it for 3 and 4 hours, you know. So, you know, Maceo is my idol. A lot of times, anything I do, I ask myself, what would Maceo do right here, you know? And I would try to do it, you know, the best I could. But Maceo is a star. He is a star.
From here on out, I'm going to ask myself, what would Fred Wesley do? After today, I said, my life has changed. I was today with this hot weather, and I was riding around. I had the windows down. I had your music going. I just felt like I was I was the mayor of Chicago.
Well, I would do what Maceo did.
Okay, good. Believe me, you know. Fred Wesley in the new JBs are the headliner at the Chicago Blues Festival tomorrow. Of course, Fred Wesley, the music director, band leader, trombonist with the JBs, with James Brown, and with Count Basie, right, and with George Clinton. And we'll talk about your other projects when we come back here after the news. Fred Wesley in studio, my guest at the big table. Stay with us.
Gotta take you high.
How about that? It's so good. Fred Wesley in studio here on The Download. I'm Justin Kaufman. The legendary horn player, trombone player, music director, band leader for the JBs, Fred Wesley, JBs. Played with James Brown, George Clinton, Count Basie, Ray Charles, Ike and Tina Turner. The list goes on and on. And I mean, it's amazing how many artists that you've been sideman for. Fred Wesley in studio is my guest tonight at the big table. He is the headliner tomorrow night at the Chicago Blues Festival here in Grant Park. I mean, we're really, it's unbelievable to be able to hear that music. I mean, that music is just, I can't get over the fact that is some of the best music that ever created. And then, you know, as the JBs kind of I guess the word is disband, right? In the mid to late 70s?
It didn't disband. It kind of petered out, you know. The band changed from my band to the next band. They still call the band the James Brown Generals, I think. I don't know, but it just kind of changed.
Why did you leave?
Well, you know, James Brown wanted me to copy somebody.
Oh, that's
he wanted me to copy Freddie Mercury and some other people, you know, and I didn't think he should do that. You know, he was famous for making up his own music, right, you know, and but he thought, I think now he thought that he had run out, you know, so he wanted to go copy some people, and I just couldn't do that. Plus, I was just tired of being on call 24 hours a day. You know, it was just too much pressure for me. You know, it was all I could take. So
at the breaking point as a musician, I mean, what do you do at that point? Because obviously you moved on to do your own stuff. You moved on to work with George Clinton. But talk about that moment in your career.
I got lucky. You know, it happened at a time I was prepared to just go to California and just be a session musician, you know. But George Clinton and Bootsy Collins is the one mm-hmm. that told me he was going to come back and get me from James Brown. You know, I said, yeah, sure, you know. But I went straight from James Brown to the George Clinton family, you know. And he gave me more opportunity to just do some good horn parts, you know. So I continued to experiment. This time I only had to do horns because Boosie was doing the rhythm tracks and he was doing the vocals, mm-hmm. you know. All I had to do was horn. George said, just give me some bad horns, you know. So I did. And I did horns as spectacular as I could, you know. And he would use some of them and not use some, but he was happy and I was happy. And we spent two really good years together.
So What was the transition like for you to go to work to working for years for James Brown and yeah. the way that you just mentioned in the last segment about how he would control things to working with another famous band leader, yeah. George Clinton? Was it similar or was it different?
The pressure was off. You know, I didn't have any pressure on me because I would just do stuff the way I wanted to do it, and George wouldn't say anything. He would just use it or not use it, you know. But at the same time, he would use most of it, and
there's great horns on those tracks.
I was getting a wealth of experience, you know, and having a lot of fun too, you know, because George Clinton had a relaxed atmosphere around the show, you know. Even with the ship landing on stage, it was still a relaxed kind of a fun endeavor, you know. We just played anything we wanted to play, and he would use it or not use it. And we were doing Boosie's Rubber Band, and Boosie had a great show. You know, you should see that film that's out now with Boosie and Halloween in Houston, Texas, 1976. It was a great show, you know, and all the shows were like that. So we were having
what
fun.
What for you? Know? I mean, coming from such, I mean, a tremendous stage show with James Brown.
Yeah.
But it was a straight ahead kind of, you know, funk, rhythm and blues show right. where it was to a spaceship landing on stage at Soldier Field. I mean, for you as a musician, who were you kind of head scratching or were you just kind of in the zone?
I was just in the zone. I was just doing my part, you know, because with James Brown, I had to be the leader. James told me, he said, anything that happens on this stage, you are responsible for it. See, that's a lot of pressure you put on a man. And to all of a sudden have that pressure taken off and they just say, just do this.
There's 28 people on stage.
Right. Just do what you do, you know. That was like
were you at
paradise
all, was it,
to me.
Was
you
it
know?
Difficult for you at all because you had come from such a strict environment?
It was easy. It was easy. All I had to do was
You weren't frustrated by it? Like you didn't? You,
no.
No.
No, I did whatever I wanted to do, you know. And George Clinton would even say, you know, I'm doing an album with George now. You know, it's a resurgence of the Parliament. You know, I won't talk about that because I let him talk about that. But, you know, George is great to work for because he doesn't dictate what you do. He just wants you to do, and then he would use it or not use it, you know. But he knows what he wants, and he knows who he wants to do it.
Now, you know? We mentioned, you know, Parliament and Funkadelic, obviously, and Bootsy Collins and everything. But the other band that you worked with as well in the 70s was the Count Basie Orchestra.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, that's a famed jazz band. That's a formal kind of band. Talk about why you joined that band and what took you out of sort of, you know, funk music.
Well, I always wanted to play with Count Basie. And the opportunity came up. Waymon Reed, a trumpet player, the same trumpet player that introduced me to James Brown, was now playing with Count Basie, and he introduced me to Count Basie. And I wasn't kind of temperamentally set to play with Count Basie, but as I always did, if I'm offered a gig, I take it, and I'll stay there until long as you let me, you know. So it was kind of rough at first. But
Why was it rough? Just because you were playing a certain... It was a different kind of music?
Different kind of music. You know, with Bootsy and George Clinton, I would play as loud as I could, as long as I could, you know. But with Count Basie, you had to play your part, right. And you had to play soft sometimes.
Very precise, right.
Precise with that. But it was a really strong swing groove, you know. And it took me a minute to get into that, but I did. And it was the best gig I ever had. Because it's from childhood, I always wanted to play with Count Basie's band. Not much soloing. I played a couple of solos, and I did a recording with three recordings with Count Basie. But it was a relaxed kind of a thing after I got into it, and I had to even change the way I dress.
Right. I've seen those pictures.
You know, go from crazy clothes to a suit and a tie, you know. And the guys in the band were just wonderful to me, and I had a great time with Count Basie's band.
Well, I mean, one of the great things about your career is your ability to, as a trombone player, as a horn player, to be able to cross over to different mediums, to different disciplines. You know, to play in James Brown, which is it's a rhythm and blues kind of to a George Clinton almost like a freeform jazz, if you will, for freeform funk. Yeah. To a more traditional jazz sound. I mean, for you, was that part of the goal? I mean, did you want to take on different?
This opportunity presented itself to me, you know. In fact, I've done a few albums of my own. I did one straight ahead jazz album, and it's called To Someone. But now that I've done some funky jazz albums, some funky jazz album, and one album that I'm selling now is called Full Circle, Bebop to Hip Hop, and it has some bebop on it and it has a hip hop on it, so it's like a full circle.
Yeah.
But now what I'm trying to do now is a blues album. I'm gonna do a blues album that would feature some old blues, you know, some Muddy Water Blues, Cotton Blues, blues from way back, you know.
Well, let's
talk. But I'm gonna do it with a big band sound.
Let's take a quick break, and then we'll wrap up, and we'll talk about the Blues Festival, because you being here, that's part of you being the headliner at the Blues Festival. Fred Wesley and the New JBs are on stage tomorrow night at the Chicago Blues Festival. Fred Wesley, of course, one of the greatest trombone players in the history of the world. We'll continue our conversation with Fred when we return. Right. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, the great Fred Wesley. Fred Wesley and the JBs, of course. James Brown's band. Also George Clinton. Also Count Basie. Also Ray Charles. Also everybody who ever played music.
Fred Wesley.
All right, so you're at the Blues Festival. You mentioned, you know, that you want to get into the blues. You want to make music you want to make blues music. What's your relationship to the blues? Because at the beginning of the interview, you talked about how you started out playing a little bit of blues.
Yeah, you know, the first thing I ever heard was blues and country and western, because I was born in the country in Georgia. And I first saw the light in Mobile, Alabama. And that's a big blues country, you know. So I just wanted to go back to my roots and play some blues, you know. But with my experience with James Brown and with Parliament Funkadelic and with Count Basie, all the experiences that I've had before kind of incorporate that
into... it's an energetic kind of funky blues.
Kind of funky and kind of jazzy too, you know. Mm-hmm. All of this would be incorporated into this album, you know. But we have to get the money for it. Nobody has stepped up to the plate yet, so we're asking for donations from.
So is that what you're gonna crowdsource the record? You're going to try and get money to make a Fred Wesley record.
Exactly.
I need to take a deep breath. People are not lining up to give Fred Wesley.
Well, not yet. Not yet. But we. We are campaigning to get finances for the record. Nobody actually, there's no market for this music, you know. But we're going to do it. We're going to do this music.
It's hard for me to fathom that the band leader of the JBs and a guy who's played with the band, all the people that we mentioned, doesn't have the kind of fanfare. I know that you tour, and you tour a lot in Europe.
Yes.
Talk about that. In Europe, they recognize the contributions you've made to music.
Yeah, I think because of we are a foreign entity that makes us more attractive to European people more so than American people. You know, America, this is home, so we just pass it up. You know, we into what's happening now, hip hop and pop music, Taylor Swift's and the Beyoncé's and the Michael Jackson, you know. But that's okay. But there is a market for what we do, a little market in America and a big market in Europe. Not a big market, but a bigger market, you know.
One that can sustain a tour.
Yeah, so we go where they want us. And there are a few people, I say jokingly, I have 2,500 fans over the world, so I'm gonna try to entertain each one of them, you know. But I'm very honored to be here in Chicago, because this is the birthplace of the blues, and I think that this is a good place for me to start my blues album, you know. So we be selling CDs and my book, and I'll be autographing them.
Right.
We're gonna have a meet and greet at the Kids Pavilion tomorrow. Where is it?
It'll be down in Grand Park.
Yeah, down in Grand Park.
You can find
it's a Kids Pavilion there.
Yeah,
and we're gonna be there from 6 to 7 selling these things and
meeting the fans. Yeah,
I want to see all 2,500 of them.
Well, Fred, I'm interested. You know, obviously, you know, you've had such a tremendous career, and it spans over so many decades. I mean, we're talking about you're talking Ike and Tina Turner in the early 60s and even performing jazz, blues, and then when your dad's band in the 50s.
Yeah.
I mean, is there a time when you stop playing, when you stop the touring and you retire from music?
Not really. Because even when I slowed down, I was in L.A. doing sessions. I did sessions with just about everybody you can think of, except Stevie Wonder.
Why not Stevie Wonder?
Because I never did. But I've always wanted to play with Steve. I never had an opportunity. But
really?
I did
of all
session.
Those names, really.
I did session with just about everybody else, you know. And so I never stopped. I stopped touring and I stopped recording, but I did do sessions on a regular basis. I even had an African client that I did some albums for, you know. But I never stopped. And I started back in 88 to 90. That's when Maceo and Bobby Bird came to me and said that Pass the Peas was a hit again in London, you know. So I had to relearn Pass the Peas
<That's>
and
amazing.
Give me some more and all that stuff, you know.
You know, those songs, Pass the Peas, Give Me Some More, Watergate, Monorail, like all the songs we've been playing through the breaks and even the stuff with that we've talked about outside of that. I mean, do you think back on the mark that you've made on American music? I mean, do you think about at all when you reflect on your career about how much that music has impacted this country?
More and more. I realize it, you know. At first, because I had forgotten about what I did with James Brown, you know, for all during the 80s, I didn't even think about what was happening, you know. And in fact, I even did a straight ahead jazz album in 1988, you know. But now that I hear music and people talk to me about music, like yourself, I realize what impact I have had on American music, on music in general, you know, and I'm very gratified to know that I have left a mark, you know. If I go pass away tomorrow, I feel like I have left an impact on the music industry.
Fred Wesley is the band leader, music director, and trombonist for the ages. I mean, you've the man behind the JB's, James Brown's band. Is going to be with the new JB's.
Yeah.
Fred Wesley and the new JB's at the Chicago Blues Festival tomorrow night, headlining.
Right.
It was my pleasure to have you here, and you're such a tremendous musician, and you have made a mark, and I appreciate you taking some time out to talk to us tonight.
Thank you very much for having me.
Wow. I forgot to ask him if he would play trombone with you, Rob.
No, I just want to listen.
That's amazing. I mean, every song that Pete bumped in with, I was like, oh, man. And to be able to play, I mean, to... I'm a little bit emotional in the way that you, like, play part of Watergate in that slide, that, you know, and he comes in with that. And for him to be talking about it while it's playing, that's like a radio moment for me. Sorry, I'm busy trying to put my picture up of me and Fred Wesley on Instagram. At Jay Coffs. Also put on GN all over the place. I just want people to know my new best friend. Yeah, what are Fred and I doing this weekend? We're just hanging out. We're going to play some horns. That was great, man. I'm such a... I really enjoy the show because you get a chance to really spread out with some artists who really do make a difference. And Fred Wesley, if you're not, and maybe you're not into R&B in any form, and maybe James Brown wasn't your cup of tea, but to hear stories where he was involved in influential movie or music in the 50s, in the 60s, yeah, in the 70s, in the 80s, you know what I mean? Like he is, as a band leader and as a sideman, was involved and had such a tremendous career with some of the stuff that is known to be some of the best music ever made. There has to be an amazing, again, Pete, we talk about this all the time on this show. How amazing was it that he said, here's a takeaway from tonight's show, we'll do the Doogie Howser stuff now. He said he started playing horns or started learning music playing piano at 3 years old.
Mm-hmm.
There it is. I mean, every time we have someone who is a special artist on the show, is a genius who has made tremendous strides and made our lives better as artists, they're like, well, I started when I was four. Yeah. Like, oh, man, I wasn't doing anything when I was four.
Just trying to figure out how to walk right still, probably.
Exactly. I had special shoes. He's learning piano, and I'm like, I don't know. I can't eat solid food. It's amazing. I mean, and the other thing I would take away from Kim Barker, who was on in the first hour, and she said about, and I thought it echoed what Hawk Harrelson said yesterday. That's what I love about the show, too, is that, you know, that she was writing a funny book about war, and that was the book she wrote, Taliban Shuffle, which was turned into the Tina Fey movie, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, people, she realized quickly, and she got good advice, that, you know what, not everybody's going to like it. Not everybody's going to think it's funny, but that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And Hawk Harrelson said the same thing about Howard Cosell, and another manager said the same thing within like a couple days where they said, you know what, you're not going to please everybody. So it's just interesting, like as these threads play out here on the download, you know, day to day and week to week, interview to interview, and you hear similar things from some of these special people, it's really great to kind of take away and realize that there are some things, some truths in our lives that, you know, come out when in these situations.
I felt bad because when Fred Wesley came in, I sat him in the green room while we were finishing up with David Singer, and he sat down. And he's like, "Can you put the TV on the basketball game?"
And
he wanted to watch the basketball game. So I like grabbed the remote. It's like a remote from the 40s. I'm trying, pressing all these buttons. Nothing's working. Nothing's going on. And I'm like, I'm sweating. The remote is attached to something because people are stealing remotes now.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Thing.
It's like tied to the dresser. That's the dresser that's there for some reason that doesn't hold any water. So like, I'm like panicking. I'm like, can I find it on my phone for you?
Well, he was, during the breaks, he would look up at our tiny TVs, like all here in the studio. We've got the 4-inch TVs that somehow are made custom. They're probably $2,500 each. They're the smallest TVs I've ever seen. Remember last year we were watching the playoff game of the Bulls, and Derrick Rose hit that winner. Remember that?
Yeah.
It was like, we're in studio, and I'm like, oh, it looks like it's the last play. I can't, it's such a small TV. Someone athletic has the ball. Something happened. I think they won. Like you can't even tell. But yeah, so he was doing that. Right. Like in the break, he was looking up at the little screen going,
All right.
Who's
bad.
Winning? And I'm like, I don't know.
It felt so bad.
Yeah.
All right, well, I'm happy now at least that he was able to at least monitor what was going on.
Well,
so great.
Chicago's a buzz tonight, man. Tremendous night. Look out here. I mean, you got the double-decker buses. You got the people walking back from dinner. This is a tremendous weekend for festivals. I mean, you heard all about it on Rose Show today that the traffic's going to be messed up. But beyond that, I mean, I was just thinking about that's kind of what makes this city such a world-class destination is that you can have all of these, I mean, really, like, world-class events.
Mm-hmm.
We can go down the list, but the America's Cup.
Yeah.
Which is a international sailboat race. I mean, that's the biggest one. That's cover Sports Illustrated type stuff happening here in Lake Michigan. First time they've had that race on fresh water in 165 years.
I'd like to thank Toast Vodka for that.
Toast
no,
Vodka.
No, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. I saw a bunch of people talking about that today.
Yeah, and great pictures from Navy Pier. People worked at Navy mm-hmm. Pier showing the boats getting in the water. Yep. Like, that was really fun. And then you got that. And then we got, obviously, we've been talking a ton about the Printers Row Lit Fest, one of my favorite festivals. I'm going to go down there tomorrow.
Nice.
I might even go Sunday, too. I just like it because it reminds me of a really fun Chicago, like, it's almost like a tradition. You walk through there, you go into the tent, you look at books. You don't have to buy anything. You duck your head in, and maybe you see an author who's talking to somebody from the Tribune. And, you know, the Tribune sponsors it, but they're separate companies than us. I'm not just shilling for them.
Yeah.
You know, it is, I think, one of the best festivals, and it's really great to see some of the greatest, in my opinion, some of the greatest writers of our time, you know, in the flesh. You don't always get a chance to see that. We rarely get to see that. What we get to see is mostly, them on Good Morning America.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, that's what that guy looks like. So you got that. You also have Spring Awakening, which is the EDM festival at Soldier Field, electronic dance music. We talked to Paul Oakenfold 2 weeks ago. You know, he wasn't a part of that. He was a different show. But the idea of the DJs at Soldier Field, which adds a whole, 60,000 people going to watch a DJ press a button.
I know. That's incredible.
I think I've told this story before, but I was, my experience with EDM music, I went and saw Dash Berlin, who's a big DJ in the scene, and it was at the Concord Music Hall. And a friend of mine was in from out of town. He's like, you want to go? I got these tickets. I'm like, I'm intrigued.
Yeah, see what it's all
but
about.
But I was coming from work, right? I was working a 9-to-5. And I had like, and I remember it was like maybe March or April. And I remember that I had on like a sweater that zipped up, you know, to the collar kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it was like, you know, I'd keep it a little bit down and it would collar up. And it was a nice look and some jeans and maybe some nice pant, like shoes.
Yeah.
So I'm like, well, I'll just meet you there. So I show up and it's like everybody is in like painter hats. Remember the old painter hats and like tank tops and like really short shorts and neon glow sticks. I mean, I look like I was the silent partner at Concord. Like I wasn't the owner. I was a silent partner just checking out or maybe like investor.
Yeah.
And I wasn't even that good, well dressed. I was just dressed like you would go to work on a Thursday or whatever. And I was just so embarrassed. I just looked around. Everyone was in their sort of club best. And I was just like, old man. I couldn't be older. I put 15 years on me with that outfit. So, yeah, that's my experience with EDM. So that's going on.
Yeah.
More, the Blues Fest.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So Grant Park is overrun with people. One of my favorite festivals. That's greatest to take a blanket down there and be able to watch some great blues musicians. And I have, I'll tell this, let's take a break. I'll tell a story, but I used to be part of the broadcast team that would broadcast the Blues Festival in Chicago. So this was probably in the early 90s or mid 90s. And so I'll talk about my experiences with blues musicians, Screamin' Jay Hawkins, all that kind of stuff that, yeah, I have some great stories about it after the break. Stay with us.
Put a spell on you. Because you're mine.
Stop. It's not that great of a story to let the Screamin' Jay Hawkins track play for 30 seconds, but
This is the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock. Coming up just in a couple minutes, local inventor, innovator, and of course, entrepreneur Steve Gadlin from I Want to Draw a Cat from You.com. He won on the show Shark Tank, and he comes here every Friday night to give his latest invention so we can poke holes on it before he brings it to his boss, Mark Cuban. 312-981-7200. Looking forward to tonight. He's going to be great. All right, so Screamin' Jay Hawkins. When I worked at NPR, we would broadcast the Blues Festival. It was a bummer when it ended. So like when I first started, I started there in 1994. And it was the tail end of broadcasting to Chicago. They would simulcast the Blues Festival on 91.5, which is super cool. Like if you think about it, not only is it a free festival, but we're going to put it on public radio. So you can hear the Blues Festival live. And how great is that, that you could do that? And at some point or another, and I never got the true story because I was always the lowest man on the pole, you know. I think it had something to do with the mayor's office of special events at a certain point before it became DK's was like, it's a free festival. We don't want to broadcast it because no one will come. And we were like, yeah, but that's not really, come on. People are giving more credit. I mean, people are still coming out. The park was full. It's even fuller than it had ever been back then. But they were like, they really kind of were like, no, it's like we're cannibalizing it. So we ended up stopped that relationship. And it was a bummer because it was unbelievable. I saw my first Blues Fest that I saw Luther Allison on stage. And if you're a blues fan, Luther Allison I believe he passed away, but Luther Allison, I think he put out a record call live in Chicago that was that set.
Ah.
It was such a great set. He's an electric blues man, guitar player. He's got that bing, 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 bing. Like, it was just so good, man. It was some of the best blues. For that to be my introduction to the blues formally, because I was there at the Blues Fest, there's just no better way. But what we would do is we'd pull those artists off, and there'd be a sound check. There'd be like a set change, 15-minute set change. So we would broadcast live, and we would do interviews with artists between the sets.
Yeah.
So we got to meet all these people. Screamin' Jay Hawkins was featured one year, one of the last years we did it. And he was supposed to come up and do an interview. And he wouldn't for some reason. If you've ever been to the Grant Park Petrillo Music Show, if you ever go downstairs, they actually have like dressing rooms and an area for hangout. It's kind of awesome when you go in there. You're like, there's a million people in there, and you're like, where are the artists? But they're like, they have little rooms, and his door was shut, right? And the only way he would come out, he had become smitten with Shirley Jihad, and Shirley was a reporter with the team. She was with the team, and she had either interviewed him for his feature or something. So all I remember being downstairs, and we're like, we need Screamin' Jay Hawkins, you know, to come up. And he wouldn't do it, and he would just go. He was in his dressing room, and I'll do my impression. It's like in my head. It's ingrained in my head. Ready? Shirley! Where's Shirley? I'm not coming out unless Shirley comes in here! And it was like he was just, and everyone's like, who's Shirley? And Shirley was one of the, you know, she's on the NPR crew. She was like embarrassed where she's like, I just interviewed him. Like there was like, you know, 150 people in this room, and he would only talk to Shirley. And that was the story. I was like, wow, this got really kind of got creepy. But he was like, so he was older and he was just like having fun with it. And it wasn't shortly thereafter that he died. But it was like, that was the fun. It was like a fun, it was really great that it was broadcast that way. And it was really cool. And I really got into the blues at that point. Like I really got into it. Like I learned that the Chicago blues was not Kingston Mines, and nothing against Kingston Mines and people,
sure.
You know, but there was much more to the blues, and I really respected the art form, and I met a lot of great people to the Jazz Fest too, that I never would have known as a white kid from Wonder Lake, Illinois, who just didn't cross over into those genres.
Yeah,
and so I have a lot of respect for those musicians and a lot of curiosity about their lives, and as Fred Wesley said, I find it interesting because they are huge in Europe. For whatever reason, blues and jazz hasn't died like it has here. And so if you go to Germany, Amsterdam, London, as he mentioned, like, you know, in the 90s, past the peas is hot again.
Yeah.
And that's weird to hear because you're like, Pass the Peas is one of the biggest songs James Brown ever did. And the idea that he can't find work, you know, to, or he can't find people interested in Pass the Peas or Give Me Some More, and he had to go relearn those songs to go play them in Europe. That's kind of, I think it's kind of a shame. This is, there's nothing as good as a James Brown sort of, that's an American, that's an American export in a way that, like, that, I mean, it should be here, not exported to Europe and other places. And we were, who were we just talking about yesterday? Scott Frankel was talking about Grey Gardens being in Japan.
Yeah.
The idea of, like, being able to see, like, Broadway musicals being exported. But there's a lot of American culture that still gets exported to Europe and Asia and other places. And those artists are making money that way. And it's not happening here. It's weird.
Disappointing.
Yeah, it is, especially for Fred Wesley. I mean, come on. But the Blues Festival is always fun. And
yeah.
there's a huge... And I, you know what? I got to look it up because I forgot who the tribute's for. But there's a huge tribute show right before Fred Wesley.
I think I was like in seventh grade going to the Blues, sixth or seventh grade. And I remember going and Chuck Berry was there.
That's awesome.
And Keith Richards showed up.
What?
Like Keith Richards came out on stage. I remember because I was a huge Rolling Stones, I was still a Rolling Stones fan, but like a huge. And like I saw Keith Richards and I was like, oh, my God, this is amazing. And then I went back
every
year. How
great is that? Yeah. And you go back. I mean, that's there's something great. I heard Mary May on Bill and Wendy 2 days ago. They were stressing the point that there are a lot of festivals in a lot of cities. But what distinguishes the festivals in the summer here in Chicago is that they are free. And there is something to that. A lot of cities have gone away from that, where they're like, it's a $15. Everyone's used to paying. It's $10.15. And even in Chicago, in a weird way, they like did the pavilion, where now it costs to get into the pavilion seats. But there really is still this Blues Fest, Jazz Fest, Taste of Chicago. I think the pavilion is just for Taste of Chicago. But the idea that that's still a free concert.
Right.
And there is something special about being able to go down there. And like you said, Keith Richards comes on stage.
Yeah.
At a free show. You didn't pay $250 for that. If you paid $250, you'd be like, I deserve Keith Richards on this stage. He better get on this stage. If he doesn't get on the stage, I'm not going to feel like I got my money's worth.
No, that's why, you know, I think we're going to go to Andersonville, you know, Midsummer Fest, you know, to see our ABBA cover band. You know, all the culture going on, I prefer the ABBA cover band. And they, you know, the local street festivals have, you know, a suggested donation, you know, to get in to, you know, support the neighborhood. And I always like, yeah, I'm going to go shopping.
I'm just going shopping.
I'm not going to stick around.
Yeah. No, I'm just going, I'm cutting through.
Yeah.
That's we do a whole show on how to get out of the suggested donation. I know. Here it's suggested donations. We haven't even gotten into that. Don't get me started.
Sorry.
On that.
It's the beginning of summer.
We'll have plenty of time to do a whole hour on how do you get out of the suggested donation. Oh, you know, I live right back there. Sorry, that's my place. Sorry. You know, my son's gotta use the bathroom. I got our dinner reservation up in this block. I'm just going home to change my pants. Sorry. There's a lot of those. All right, so good. We'll do that. We'll do that coming up. I guess even back then you can call me CEO of the ROCO. Fresh out the frying pan into the fire. My pony dog can judge me, so I'm gone. Either love me or leave me alone. Yeah. Who doesn't like that song? I find Pete Zimmerman. All right. Welcome back here to the download. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's 10 o'clock on Friday, and you know what that means. It's time for, one of our favorite segments of all time. It's time to put Shark Tank Steve Gadlin into the frying pan. Gadlin is the brains behind a successful local business, IWantToDrawACatForYou.com. He presented his business idea on the television program Shark Tank, and he snagged Mark Cuban as a principal investor. So now Steve has to go back to Mark Cuban with new ideas. Before he goes into that pressure cooker, he comes to WGN Radio to jump into the frying pan. Yeah. He's giving us his exclusive business ideas so we can poke holes into it and give Steve the confidence to pitch it to Cuban himself. Steve Gadlin, welcome back to the frying pan, my friend.
Thank you, sir. I'm happy to be here.
How you feeling? I know that this week you've been very confident. I said earlier in this program that it felt like you may have gotten your swagger back.
Yeah, you know, I think I had a lot of my swagger pummeled out of me last week by some of your callers who once again misunderstood a pretty good idea. But I think, you know, I think I've got a golden one for them today. So hopefully I'll earn that swagger with a winner.
Well, we know you to be a confident guy. You wouldn't be in the invention business if you weren't.
True. True. Entrepreneurism takes a lot of confidence.
Right. 312-981-7200. Are we ready to play the frying pan? I think we are. Steve Gadlin, what's this week's frying pan idea?
Yeah, so this time I came up with an invention, and this has nothing to do with food. I know I had a couple of strikeouts with food ideas over the last few weeks. So this is called whisper phones. Now, people are talking at you all the time, especially if you're out in the city. You hear people talk, talk, talk. And for some older people, you know, 40 and above, some of the elderly, it's a little hard for them to hear all these noises of people talking and shouting. So whisper phones are a headphone apparatus that you wear out in public. And what they do is they convert all talking into the soft, soothing sounds of whispering. So you still hear what people are telling you. But instead of them, you know, hearing it like they're shouting at you or talking roughly, it comes through as a soft, soothing whisper. And it actually, what we found in our studies is it greatly reduces a person's stress levels over the course of a day. And that improves heart health and extends your life.
Okay. The idea this week is whisper phones, headphones that turn normal talking into whispers.
Well, headphone apparatus.
Okay, apparatus.
I can get more into that later, but
all right.
But you got the gist of it.
Yes.
It turns all talking that you hear into the soft, soothing sounds of whispers.
312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. The calls are coming in right now. Pete is on the line calling them and screening them, getting them ready to go here. Steve, okay, so I have questions, but as normal procedure here in the frying pan, I like to leave them to the audience because I don't want to sort of steer the conversation or use my biases or subjectivity to color anybody's opinion. So,
well, I tell you, your bias usually ends up sneaking in there by the second or third call.
Doubtful. Not me. I try to keep it straight ahead here on the frying pan. 312-981-7200. The idea called whisper phones. One more time, Steve.
Yeah, whisper phones. So they are the headphone apparatus for people who are 40 and above that turns some of the sharp, rough talking you might hear on the streets into the soft, soothing sounds of whispering.
Okay, and yeah, I have some technology questions, but we'll get to that. I'm sure that there will be some people who will answer those or ask those questions. 312-981-7200. Let's take a quick break. We'll get the calls lined up, and then we will get to the responses.
Get to the yays.
All right.
Get to the yays.
Stay with us. Fresh out the frying pan into the fire. Only God can judge me, so I'm gone. Either love me or leave me alone. It's a frying pan. Friday nights here on WGN on the download. Steve Gadlin joins us. He's a local entrepreneur behind IWantToDrawACatForYou.com. He won on Shark Tank, so now he comes here with new ideas before he pitches them to his boss, Mark Cuban. All right, Steve Gadlin, this week's idea, whisper phones.
Yeah, the whisper phones. So, you know, especially elderly people, 40 and above, when you go to a baseball game or a sporting event or you're out in the city, some of the noise is just overwhelming. What the whisper phones will do is convert that sound, the sound of human talking, screaming, shouting, into the soft, soothing sounds of whispering.
312-981-7200 is the phone number. Let's go to Mark. Mark, what do we like, yay or nay on whisper phones?
I'd have to go with a nay on this one. Mm-hmm. It seems like the demographic you're looking at could just turn down their hearing aids or put on a pair of headphones.
Yeah.
It also sounds like you're trying to block an entire range of sound, which could be, you know, really dangerous if you're just canceling out an entire spectrum of sound.
Yeah.
That's a great question. Thanks, Mark. Thanks for that. Steve, what do you say to the
idea?
Yeah,
well, this is, you know, it's not for blocking out sound. I'll say that. It doesn't block out talking. It changes those sounds into the soft, soothing sounds of whispering. So it, you know, it's not, you'll still hear everything everyone says. You'll hear it very clearly.
Right.
But instead of different voices at different levels, you'll hear, you know, whisper sounds.
Okay, 312-981-7200. Let's 630 says, would a car horn sound? What would it sound like with a whisper phone?
Well, that's a great question. Just imagine the timbres of a car horn, but as a whisper.
So it would sound like it would sound like that.
Well, it would sound like if a horn were to say that. But I'm not a car horn, so I can't make that noise physically. But I think if you just imagine converting a car horn, pretend a car horn is telling a secret.
But are you at all worried about, you know, those kind of sounds are important because they're alerting you or they're alarming you to some situation, so you wouldn't necessarily want those to be in whisper form.
Well, but you know what? You would still hear them. Mm-hmm. You'd still hear them, but instead of being jarring and abrasive, your ears would be tickled and coddled by the soft, soothing sounds of whispering.
847 says, great. I love it.
That's great.
There you go. Let's go to Julie on the line. Julie, yay or nay on whisper phones?
Well, before I give you my answer, the guy who came up with this idea, what's his name?
Steve Gadlin.
Steve. Okay, Steve, can I whisper something to you?
Okay.
Sure.
For referring to people over the age of 40 as elderly, I would like to give you a nice soft kick in the pants. And then a double thumbs down on your idea.
There you go. So, now, okay, thank you for that. Thank you, Julie.
I should have been wearing my whisper phones for that one. I'll tell you, I'm sorry. I apologize for using the word elderly. That's probably not in vogue right now. But, I mean, people over the age of 40 who are starting to get frustrated by the speed at which the world is moving these days, you know, some of the loud noises you might hear out at a sporting event or at a concert. So I apologize, though, if I used offensive nomenclature to classify people over the age of 40.
Right.
You know, and then I guess double thumbs down on the idea I can't really respond to other than to say it might not be your cup of tea, but, you know, maybe someday it will be.
I'm interested in the technology. I'm getting texts like on how this would actually work. I mean, how would you be able to mute or change the frequency of a sound?
Well, we're not changing the frequency of anything. So the way it works is actually fairly ingenious. We have the apparatus goes over your ears and actually mutes all sound. Okay. So you can't hear a thing when you're wearing them, but when turned on, if there are batteries, if the batteries are up to date, it actually works a lot like Siri on your phone, and that it captures the sounds, sends them on to our servers. Okay. Where we have people ready to redeliver those sounds using proprietary technology as whisper. So, so there's maybe a 5 to 8 seconds of latency while the sound is processed and converted and then sent back to your ears. But that delay is something you get used to after 1 or 2 days of normal use.
It's almost like a delay you see on TV when a reporter is in a using Skype or something, and it's 5 seconds after the question.
Yeah, except there won't be any delay in what you see, obviously. But we do have an attachment that we're working on that will add that delay to what you see so that everything is in sync. But we're not ready with that yet.
Okay, 312-981-7200. This is a lot of technology, and I'm assuming the ability to delay is going to cost money. How much is this going to cost, Steve?
Well, so Whisperphone is actually, we got a low bar to entry this time.
Okay.
So it's $25 for a pair.
Okay.
And then you will need, though, a monthly subscription to keep the you know, to keep the service working so that the people we have on our end who are doing the translation for you can get paid. And it's actually per sound. So it's based on the number of sounds we translate for you per month. It could be, you know, as low as $3.99 a month, sort of $399 a month for people who engage in low to average to low numbers of conversations in a month, all the way up to, you know.
You would do it by conversations.
Well, by sound, really. It's, again, a proprietary formula that calculates the number of sounds we have to translate. And then, you know, I'll say $3.99 is general entry level for people who hear a normal amount of things in a month. Mm-hmm. And we might have to, you know, if you work at a ballpark, I'll say, mm-hmm. that could get pretty expensive. So we have to work out a custom plan for you.
So it's almost like a data plan for cell phones.
Yeah, very similar to a data plan. But you know what? I don't like to harp on the price. It's not the pricing that excites me here. It's the technology. It's, again, taking the harsh sounds of life and replacing them with the soothing sounds of whisperings.
(312) 981-7200 Let's go to Jeremy. Jeremy, yay or nay on whisper phones?
I think it's a great idea. I'm actually a musician, and I go to a bunch of concerts, and I actually wear earbuds through the concert, some high-grade earbuds, so I don't blow out my eardrums.
There you go. So this could be,
I think it's a great idea.
This could be marketed to that generation. Thanks a lot, Jeremy.
Yeah, and again, instead of the, you know, the tonal variance of some concerts, you'll get that music back to you in a nice, soothing monotone of, which would make the concert much more enjoyable.
All right. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. 312-981-7200. We'll take a break for the news. We'll continue with the frying pan. Whisper phones. Whisper phones is the idea tonight. Steve Gadlin, the entrepreneur. We'll be right back with Steve and the frying pan. Stay with us. All right. The frying pan's actually doing pretty good. A couple nays to start, but have kind of given us a couple of yays towards the end here, which we will take, I guess. 312-981-7200. More with Steve Gadlin. Rob Martier, what do you think of whisper phones?
No, absolutely not. Steve, and you know, I'm a huge Gadlin fan. Yeah. I love Steve. You know that. This one I can't endorse. Can't do it.
How does that make you feel, Steve?
Well, I don't know that Rob Martier has ever really experienced the soft, soothing sounds of whispering.
I've got four kids. There is no type of whispering going on in my house.
Right.
None at all.
Well, with whisper phones, you'd have four delightful, soft-soothing children.
There you go. See, you could use the whisper phones. Thanks, Steve. Okay. I guess even back then you can call me CEO of the ROC. Ho, fresh out the frying pan into the fire. Only God can judge me, so I'm gone. Either love me or leave me. It's the frying pan here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman, and our guest tonight, of course, Steve Gadlin, local entrepreneur, innovator, and inventor, the man behind IWantToDrawCatsForYou.com. He won on Shark Tank. That means he has a development deal with Mark Cuban. Before he brings any new ideas to Cuban, he brings them here to Download Nation. Steve Gadlin, tonight, whisper phones.
Yes. That's right, whisper phones. It's an apparatus that similar to a headphone. You put over your head and you tap a couple of bolts into the middle of your neck just for acoustic clarity. And
Wait. I had not heard that yet. You drill into your neck?
No. You don't break skin. There are some bolts that press into the sides of your neck, and that just helps accentuate acoustic clarity. But what they do is they block out sound and reprocess it and turn all of the hubbub and din of the city and of loud talkers into the soft, soothing sounds of whisperings.
Yes. Okay. 312-981-7200. Lots of texts, calls, people waiting. Thank you for waiting through the news. Shirley, yay or nay on whisper phones?
It's Charlene, and I say nay. You could buy orange little plums for 39 cents at any drugstore or dollar store. Put them in your ears, and you hear enough to be safe. But it also locks it out, and you don't have a monthly charge. You just have to buy a new orange cheap plugs every so often.
There you go.
Nuts.
How do you deal? Nuts. Thank you. Thank you. How do you deal with competition, Steve?
Well, the cheap orange plugs. That's what I hear all the time. And that's just, you know, that's a cheap orange plug is the equivalent to whisper phones as maybe the old Motorola flip phone was to the iPhone. You know, once the new thing comes out, I think people are going to look at those orange plugs in a whole new way. Also, I don't know that those orange plugs are Bluetooth compatible, so they will not connect to your phone. So I'd actually like to know what Shirley thinks of that. How's she going to, you know, how's she going to use them if they're not Bluetooth compatible and they won't hook up to her phone? So, you know, just we'll agree to disagree with Shirley, but I have a feeling she'll be an active user of whisper phones before the end of the
year.
You think that
it has a lot to do with just once it gets picked up, once it gets into the cultural stratosphere, that everybody will want one of these?
Yeah, those cheap orange plugs, people aren't going to use those anymore.
630 says, could the listener choose the type of whisper, like the voice on a GPS? Like man, woman accent or Apple nondescript accent? That kind of
thing. You know, that's not a feature that we're launching, but it's a coincidence that they bring that up because that is something I hadn't thought of. And it is a feature I will be rolling out eventually for an additional fee. But, you know, initially it's just a standard whisper.
773 says, if you're hard of hearing, wouldn't this make it even more difficult to hear? And if everything came through as a whisper, wouldn't it be dangerous not hearing sirens and other warning sounds, which I brought up earlier?
Yeah, so you would hear. So this isn't for people who are hard of hearing. This is for people who are maybe extra sensitive to sounds, you know, who are tired of the noisiness, the loudness and the brashness of other people's voices or crowds. And sirens, you will hear sirens. They will just be translated with, you know, the 7 or 8 second delay in play of, you know, the whisper, the sound as if a siren could whisper.
Let's go to Rick. Rick, yay or nay on whisper phones, Rick?
You know, I'm just not feeling it. I think, first of all, with the latency that you're talking about, I think this is going to be very difficult for anybody to have a conversation. And I just think the whole idea is beyond ridiculous. I feel like this is I'm getting punked, or this is an SNL skit or something. It just, and I don't know what's up with the Frankenstein bolts and the size of the neck. The whole thing just seems ludicrous to me.
Steve?
Well, that's his opinion, obviously. I mean, I'd say a lot of inventions seem ludicrous before they're put into public use. Imagine what the first people who used eyeglasses must have looked like to people who didn't need eyeglasses.
Yeah, Rick, what do you say to that, Rick?
Well, I say when people use eyeglasses, when I look at something, I'm seeing it in real time. I mean, so I'm walking down the street and there's a siren, and 8 seconds later, I hear it. By that time, I'm run over. You know, I just don't get it.
Well, you have to use your other senses, Rick. I mean, we're not asking you to only, you know, close your eyes while you're walking around. This is, you know, having a conversation with someone is actually helps, because how often when you're in a conversation do you interrupt or speak too soon and not give yourself time to really process the words they've said before offering your own opinion? You know, whisper phones almost force that to happen by giving you that 8 second delay. You see their mouth move, so you know they've been saying something, but then 8 seconds later you get that soft, soothing sound of whispering.
Okay.
And then you've had time to really process it.
I'm going to say good luck on your – I don't get this at all. But the one thing I'm going to tell you is, because I think you're trying to sell your invention here, every time you say whisper, you go pss, 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 and it drives me crazy. Quit doing that.
Well, I'm explaining the soft, soothing sound of whispering.
Okay. All right. Well, good luck.
All right. Thanks, Rick. Appreciate that.
All right. Yeah. Bye.
Okay.
Sorry, I lost it there. I lost it for a second.
Yeah. Okay. 312-981-7200. Let's see. There's a lot of stuff about solar energy, which I'm not sure has anything to do with what we're talking about.
No.
But yeah, I mean, he makes a good point. I think I've heard a lot, and you know, I was going to save it for the next segment, but it just does feel like a lot of people are responding to the abrasiveness and the annoyingness of your whisper sound.
Of my whisper sound?
Yeah, they're not feeling the pss, 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 pss on the radio. It's just not, it's something that they're feeling
well,
like as you try to sell
the
segment.
The
well, they're just saying as you're trying to sell the segment, it's not helping it.
Well, you know, again, I think if they maybe cancel out some of the other noises around them. And if everyone, you know what, let's do this. If everyone can just be quiet for a second, if your listeners could just take a deep breath and listen carefully to the soft, soothing sounds of whispering.
Yeah, see, that's, yeah, that's not. All right, let's go to George. Let's keep going. Let's get go to George. George, yay or nay on whisper phones?
That's a resounding nay. I don't know, like, this is a joke, right? This has got to be a joke. This is about as bad as the idea that guy had that he wanted to do that fantasy sports camp where kids were pretending to play.
This is the same guy.
This is the same guy?
Yeah, it's the same. He does the same segment every night, every Friday night.
I'm not surprised one bit.
Okay.
This is becoming, like, entertainment for me. Like, this is
Well, I guess it's something, right?
I'm convinced that you're not serious with this.
Well, he is. I think that people get the misconception. This is not a SNL sketch. Steve Gadlin may have somewhat out of bounds, you know, sort of fantasy-like ideas.
You know, I said the same thing last time. This is the guy with the cats, right? The cats.
Yeah.
Okay, I said this last time. You had a really quirky, like, weird idea that took off, and I think you're trying to ride that wave with other quirky ideas.
Well, I don't see these as quirky, and I don't see that other one as quirky. What I'm trying to do is bring value to our culture. That's, to put it in a nutshell, I'm trying to bring value to our culture, and I may do that in non-traditional ways, but...
conversation in real time is valuable, and you're not really improving that, and playing sports without balls is not valuable. I mean, what value are you bringing? You're devaluizing all of the things you're trying to improve.
No, the value that I bring is the soft, soothing sound of whispering.
Right, exactly. Chill out on the whisper. Now, you did a good job there of making it a little bit
just
more
keep doing
palatable.
The whisper thing. Keep doing it. It's funny. It's making a lot of people mad. It's making me laugh.
Thanks, George.
Thanks.
All right, let's go to Jim. Jim, what do you think? Yay or nay on whisper phones?
Tell the city to stop the whispering. First of all, it's an idiotic idea, and his whispering is creepy. If I was there, I'd give him a slap. Stop it, please.
All right, there you go, Jim. He's getting kind of... All right, let's go to Glenn. Glenn, what do you like, yay or nay on whisper phones?
Yay and nay. I'm not too sure about it. I know that every time he does a, I wish I had hair. but if he could use them, like, as a translator, it might have some merit.
Okay, that's a good idea.
And as far as the Saturday Night Live skit, I would think it'd be more like Second City TV.
Yeah, right.
As a translator, I might have merit, but
okay.
Other than that,
thanks, Glenn. I appreciate that. Thanks for calling in. You're getting a lot of people here who are upset with the whispering, and also think that the idea is not that great.
Well, what Glenn did is he brought up a really good point, though, because he had said, when I make the whispering sound, you wish you had a pair. And what I'm not sure what would happen, and I'll have to bring it into testing, is how do whisper phones translate the soft, soothing sound of whispering?
How do whispers translate in whispers, right?
Yeah, what's whisperier than a whisper?
What's whisper than a whisper?
Yeah.
I think this would be better suited for home use. Maybe incorporate soothing sounds like ocean waves and white noise. That's for 630.
Okay.
And so that
well,
could be good.
You know, that's something else. That's different. You can't translate someone's voice into an ocean wave unless you're talking to fish people or something. I don't know how that would sound. This is not getting rid of any sounds. It's simply converting them into the soft, soothing sounds of whispering.
312-981-7200. We'll take a quick break. We come back. We'll bring you up to speed on some of the more colorful texts that we received in the hour. Steve Gadlin, it's the Frying Pan. Stay with us.
Fresh out the frying pan into the fire. Only God can judge me, so I'm gone. Either love me or leave me alone.
It's a download here on WGN Radio, and it's Frying Pan, Friday night, 10 o'clock. Steve Gadlin is with us now. 312-981-7200. Jeff. Yay or nay on whisper phones?
Absolutely not. You know how annoying that is to have somebody whisper in your ear all the time? And stop freaking whispering, dude. It's freaking annoying.
Okay.
I got grandkids that are less annoying than you.
Okay, there you go. So that's a good start to this segment. Okay.
I don't understand what's happening is over the radio, the sound is becoming less soft and soothing. But if you were in the room with me, or if you had the whisper phones comfortably nestled against your ears, I think would be very soothing to you.
All right, here we go. Let's go through some of the texts that came through. All right, here we go. From Paul in Glendale Heights, what if the guy you're talking to on the whisper phone is whispering to you?
Well, you're not talking to someone on a whisper phone. This is a pair of, it's a head apparatus that translates all conversation. But yeah, he raises the same question we raised earlier. I'm not sure what happens to whispering when processed through whisper phones.
We're going
to
go.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say we're going to go rapid fire here so I can get all these texts in because there's a lot tonight. And we only have about 5 minutes.
Go ahead.
Okay, so here we go. 630 says, this guy has some really bad ideas. Maybe if I was drunk, I would like it. But keep up the good work the rest of the time.
Okay.
Yeah, I think he's talking to me in the sense of keep up the good work, but not necessarily. No. 630 says, this one is great. People are as irritated as they were for the Master Gardener or the sports camp. So you're at least getting somewhere.
So that's a yay?
Yeah, I think that's a yay.
Okay.
224 says, I'm starting to think this guy is a one-trick pony. No great ideas since I want to draw a cat for you.com.
Well, that's great. 765. At least acknowledge that was a great idea.
Yeah, 765 says, is this the same guy that was promoting the toilet and the pooping bucket in your house, changing your diet to the point where you don't poop anymore?
Yes. They remember. That's right. That was a system, reusable toilet paper.
Right.
Yeah.
815 says, Mark Cuban would probably like to wear these when this idiot talks to him.
Well, they'd translate everything I say to the soft, soothing sound of whisperings. Right.
630 says, stop having this guy on. He's bringing us down.
Okay.
That's not good. 708 said it would be annoying to the point of suicide or homicide.
Well, then you just take them off. Yeah. If they're really getting
exactly.
you take
That's
them
a great
off.
Point. That's a great. He should go draw a cat for me. That's what it's Hold on.
I think you're saying that because you're skipping a lot of the yays.
No. The ones that we've already talked to or I've brought up questions. 606 says, not going to insult my intelligence by commenting on this. However, I will continue to consume my Irish whiskey. 847 says, this guy is pushing a snake oil idea. Even if it did work, his constant imitation of whispers is enough to turn me off for the product.
Well, listen, if it's, it is snake oil in the sense that snakes also go
Right. Well, I guess you can go there. 630, pretty simple. Are you insane? No punctuation on that, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, we don't know if it's a question or a statement. So.
Right. 847 says we're losing brain cells again. 312 says, why does he keep doing that? So annoying. 847 says,
great inventions?
Yeah, this guy says, I'm turning my radio off. He sucks.
Okay.
847 said, great. I love it.
Great.
847 also eight four seven says Mark Cuban would shoot this guy if he ever brought this idea to him. I didn't know that Mark Cuban was a gun guy, but
no, he's not, and he doesn't shoot people. He doesn't invest in their ideas.
Yeah. 773 says I can't wait till after the election and Dr. Trump deports you to Argentina for such dumb ideas.
Well, I'm not Argentinian, so I don't know how you could do that legally.
And then one of my favorites here is 847. Why doesn't he create headphones so we can't hear his stupid ideas? That's pretty good.
Well, those are called headphones, and they're already invented.
Right.
And, 847, I don't want to make guesses, but that's the area code my parents live in.
Right. So you these could be your parents?
It could be. It's something I'll have to ask them about.
And 773, we'll end it tonight with, have you considered a career change?
Yeah, I consider career change every week when I bring up another invention or business idea. So, yes. But I will always maintain the career of entrepreneur and visionary.
There you go. Steve, I don't think this was that bad. I think people were probably
really?
More... Well, I think they were angry at your presentation. Usually it's the other way around. Usually I feel like people think the idea is terrible and you're an okay salesman. But this one, because of the nonstop, incessant whispering, I think you got to them to a point where they're not even listening to the idea. They
it's
just
not nonstop and incessant. It's the soft, soothing sounds of whispering.
There it is. Steve Gadlin from IWantToDrawACatForYou.com. We're not on next week because we're at the Taste of Displain, so you get a week off to think about your ideas a little bit more.
I will, and I'll come up with a real good one.
All right, that sounds good. Steve Gadlin, a regular here on The Frying Pan. Thanks, my friend, and have a great weekend.
Yeah, you too. Take care.
That was a good frying pan tonight. I won't do that. I'll let that be Steve Gadlin's thing for you. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. A great week. This week was great, and next week is even better. There's so many great people that are coming through our studio in the next couple weeks. June is just abundant with guests. I'm looking forward to being back on the air on Monday. Have a great weekend, everybody. Have a great weekend, Rob Martyr.
You do the same.
And we will be back here on Monday.